To order, I see the time is 10:32 and today is March 28th. I would like to welcome committee members and guests. And I'm going to ask if the recording has been turned on. Jackie?
Recording has been turned on.
Okay, and I will ask Jerry to take roll call.
Senator John Coghill.
Here.
Senator Tom Begich.
Here.
Representative Sarah Hannon.
Here.
Representative Delana Johnson.
Here.
Member Skip Cook.
Here.
Member Connor Thomas.
Here.
Member Joyce Anderson.
Here.
Member Deb Fancher.
Here.
Member Lee Holmes.
Here.
Note that we also have in attendance our alternate Senate members, Senator L.V. Gray Jackson and Senator David Wilson in attendance. With that, we have a quorum to conduct business.
All right, thank you. Okay, we also have Dan Wayne, who is here. He's with LAA Legal. He will be attending the meeting, and he's sitting right up front there. Jackie Yeagel, our administrative assistant, is sitting over here taking minutes. I would ask all committee members and guests to please identify themselves each time they speak for the benefit of individuals on teleconference and in the audience. Today we will have a full agenda. We're anticipating the meeting maybe 3 hours or less. And I need to ask at this time, is there anyone online? We have anybody online? No one's online at this point. Okay. I would like to welcome our new legislators. We have some legislators from the House with us, which was not organized at the time of our last meeting. So we now have Representative Delana Johnson is here. She is the regular member on the committee. And then we also have Representative Sarah Hannon. She is the alternate member that's sitting in for Representative Louise, is it Stutz?
Stutz,
okay. And as Jerry mentioned, we have a couple other legislators that are in our presence as well. Okay.
Madam Chair?
Yes?
Just to recognize Chris Tuck, who's been following this with some degree of interest down through the years, who I've worked closely with, and so I just wanted to make sure he is mentioned because he will be a significant part of this work.
Welcome, Representative Tuck, who is also my legislator. Okay, the next item on the agenda is approval. So is there a motion to approve the agenda as presented?
So moved.
So moved. Okay, Senator Begich, any objection? None? Okay, the agenda has been approved. Okay, we are now at the full minutes of the committee meeting from January 31st. I hope everyone has had a chance to look at the minutes.
Tab B for committee members.
Mm-hmm. Move approval.
Okay, there is a motion to approve the minutes as presented. Is there any objection?
Madam Chair, I'm not on the committee, but I mentioned in these minutes, or quoted in these minutes pretty extensively, and I had found two places I wanted to suggest making a little change.
Okay, go ahead, Dan Wayne.
On page 6, in the middle of the page, there's a single line that says, Dan Wayne replied he did not think the rule would necessarily interpret it that way. I probably said would necessarily be interpreted that way.
Where are you on the page, Dan?
In the middle of the page.
Middle, okay. I see. So,
paragraph 4.
So you would like it to read?
Dan Wayne replied he did not think the rule would necessarily be interpreted that way.
Be interpreted, okay. Be interpreted that way. Okay, you had another suggestion?
Yes, on page 8. In the fourth chunk of text, it starts with Dan Wayne agreed. Mm-hmm. On line 4, the sentence, if a legislator looks at a bill, I'd like to suggest inserting a couple of words, if a legislator looks at requesting a draft of a bill.
Okay. Any other suggestions, Dan?
No, thank you, Madam Chair.
And I also did find, as Chair, I also did find on page 5, on the the third full paragraph down on the second line where it says advocate for. It should say advocate for a bill during a meeting instead of a during meeting. Should be reversed, the two words. So it should say advocate for a bill during a meeting.
Mm-hmm.
Right there. Instead of saying for a bill a during meeting.
Oh.
So we'll just turn that one around. I had forgotten that I had picked that up. So we actually have three corrections, one on page 5, we have one on page 6, and one on page 8. We already had a motion to approve the minutes, but I believe it was Skip. Skip, do you want to amend that motion?
Those are all fine with the maker of the motion.
Okay. Any objection to approving the minutes as amended? Okay. So moved. Okay, this is the point in our agenda where we ask for any public comment. So if there is anyone that's either online or in the audience that would like to provide any comments to the Ethics Committee, now is the time to do that. Anyone in the audience? Doesn't look like it. Anybody online? No? Okay, so no public comment at this time. The next item on our agenda is tab C in your packet. And it has to do with the elections. At our previous meeting on January 31st, we did elect a Senate subcommittee chair and vice chair. I am the Senate subcommittee chair, which according to the statute, I serve as chair of the full committee in this year. The Senate subcommittee vice chair is Deb Bancher. We were unable to do anything with the House because we didn't have any House members. So at this point, what we need to do is Connor is currently serving as House committee chair. A subcommittee chair. And so I'm going to ask for any nominations. I'd like to point out that the chairs and the vice chairs of the committee are limited to public members. So a legislator may not be a member or may not be a chair or a vice chair. And that's the way the Ethics Committee was set up, which by the way was in 1991. So that's a ways back. It's been set up that way. So I'm opening up for nominations. Is there a nomination for one of the public members to serve as the House subcommittee chair, who will serve as the full committee chair next year?
I'll move that Lee Holmes be serve as the chair and Connor Thomas as the vice chair of the House subcommittee.
Okay. Are there any other nominations? Okay. Do we need to, can we do a voice, can we just do a voice vote or do we need to do a roll call vote? Jerry.
I'm prepared to do a roll call vote with the members.
Let's do a roll call vote then. Roll call vote for Lee Holmes to be chair of the House subcommittee and Connor Thomas to be vice chair of the House subcommittee. Go ahead, Jerry.
Member Deb Fancher.
Yes.
Member Lee Holmes.
Yes.
Representative Delana Johnson.
Yes.
Representative Sarah Hannon.
Yes.
Member Skip Cook.
Yes.
Member Connor Thomas.
Yes.
Member Joyce Anderson.
Yes.
With that vote of 7-0, those two people are as chair and vice chair, respectively.
All right, congratulations to you both. Just want to make a note that the House subcommittee will meet at 1 p.m. today. So Lee, you are aware that the House subcommittee is meeting at 1 p.m. Okay.
Power.
So congratulations. You know, I think I want to go back a second since we seem to have a little bit more time than we had anticipated because we don't have one advisory opinion. I know we have new legislators on the committee, and I think the legislators aren't familiar with the public members on the committee, at least the two new ones that are here. So if maybe the public members could just go around and just give two or three sentences about themselves. Deb, we'll start with you.
Sure. My name is Deb Fancher. I'm a retired educator. Grew up in rural Alaska, have lived in Anchorage the last 30 years, taught for 23 of those 30, and loved it most of the time.
Thank you, Deb. Connor?
My name is Connor Thomas. I'm from Nome, Alaska. I'm an attorney. I practiced law there for the last 40 years. And I have served on the committee for 20 years.
Skip.
I'm Skip Cook from Fairbanks. I was born and raised in Fairbanks, born in 1940. practiced law for 43 years there, and I'm retired. And I've been on this committee for about 21 years, I think.
Yes, he has. Okay. Lee?
Lee Holmes, mechanical engineer out of Anchorage. Been in Alaska. This will be 36 years this year. And currently residing mostly in Fairbanks, it seems, but got on the committee a couple years ago. And now that we have at least an alternate from Juneau, I would say that we still are looking for an alternate public member, and it would be great to get somebody from the southeast, the underrepresented area on this committee.
Thank you for that plug. I'm Joyce Anderson, and I was the former administrator for the committee from 2001 to 2015, and then retired at that time, and then submitted my name to the Chief Justice to be on the committee, so I now have been on the committee for a couple of years. My first time as chair, but so I do have a little bit of background regarding history and so forth. I know a lot of the legislators who have been here from 2015 going that way, but the new ones I'm not familiar with, so, and there seems to be a lot. So anyway, that's sort of the makeup of the public members of the committee. So thank you. And I think we are aware of the legislators because their bios are out there, so I don't think I will go through the legislators unless any of the legislators feel they want to come in. No? Go ahead.
I share with Ms. Fancer. I am a retired, I grew up in Anchorage, but moved to Juneau and spent 20 years in a classroom here, and retired and apparently didn't read the memo correctly about what retirement meant. ran for office in retirement. When I was a student, I served on the Board of Regents with, I believe, Skip's brother, because he certainly looks like Mr. Cook was on the Board of Regents, but it wasn't Skip. So I assume it's the same family, and I'm not sure what Ms. Fancer taught. I was a high school social studies teacher.
Chemistry.
God bless you.
I agree.
Yeah.
Give 30 kids fire, you know?
What? Yeah, I know. That's exactly. I was thinking flammable materials. I had social studies, so you can keep the maps on the table. Bring that mindset of an educator to the opportunity to learn as a legislator, and there is endless homework and endless opportunity to learn new things every day. So,
thank you. Representative Johnson, you have any words that you want to say, or no? Okay, all right. Just thought
good to be here. Good to be here.
Okay, thank you. Okay. The next item on the agenda is advisory opinion requests, and we have several. Advisory opinion 1902, which we are going to go through right now. That is tab D in your the committee members' packet. That advisory opinion contains 18 questions, so there are quite a few there. And I think instead of just me reading through the questions, we're going to have Dan Wayne go through. Dan, I think it's best for the committee and for the members of the public and anyone online who is here to maybe just go through them one by one instead of just giving an overview, unless you think they can be combined in the answers.
I think that's a good idea, Madam Chair, although each answer is preceded by a question. So, I mean, I could skip over the first three pages of just questions.
Okay.
And go.
Okay.
If that's okay.
That sounds good.
So on page four, we start with a statement of facts, and it's short. It just says that the facts are accompanying the foregoing questions. And I think there's a good place to put a change. Right, instead of saying accompanying under statement of facts, we should cross that out and say included within, because otherwise it's confusing. It makes it sound like there was the questions and then something stapled to the back, and there wasn't. It was just the question, and the facts are included within the question. In the discussion, your questions refer to the bill, and where they do that, we interpret that to mean HB 44. And then it describes one of the provisions changed by HB 44, which is the main, one of the two main changes that's covered in this draft, AS 2460-030E3. and it's set out below on the bottom of page 4. It says, except as provided in G of this section or while participating in a public discussion or debate, the legislator may not directly or authorize or by authorizing another to act on the legislator's behalf, take or withhold official action or exert official influence that could substantially benefit or harm the financial interest of a person. And then it lists 4 different persons. And the word person is important, as Jerry Anderson pointed out at the last meeting, towards the end. It does have meaning. It's not defined in the Ethics Act, but what it probably doesn't include is, for example, would be an entire industry or a region of the state or something like that. It would be something more along the lines of, you know, a corporation, a natural person, an employer of some kind. But it's not, you know, it's not an endlessly broad term. And it lists, you know, A through D list 4 different types of persons. And what, on page 5, says that where your questions refer to conflict or conflict of interest, we understand they refer to a conflict of interest under 2460.30(e)(3). And I think that's important because there's a lot of, when you say conflict or conflict of interest, it means a different thing to a different, you know, whoever is, hears the term might have something, some different idea about what it means in their mind. And really, we're just talking about conflicts under E3. And there's 4, you know, A through D. It notes that official influence is not defined by the Act. However, we've previously found the meaning of official action to be broad enough to include legislative action, a term defined in 2460.990A10 as conduct relating to the development, drafting, consideration, sponsorship, enactment or defeat, support or opposition to or of a law, amendment, resolution, report, nomination, or other matter affected by legislative action or inaction. That's quite a mouthful. But it's important because official action appears in that statute. It starts on the previous page. And it's, you know, it's turned out to be a real issue. You know, how broad does that definition go? What kind of types of things does it include? And this opinion attempts to try and draw some lines and maybe narrow that definition a little bit. As a preliminary matter, we note that the prohibition under 2460.30(e)(3) does not apply in a circumstance when the sole effect of the prohibited conduct would be to substantially benefit or harm the financial interest of a person who's not listed under E3A through D. While E3 clearly implies that the financial interest of a legislator or another person who's not listed might indirectly benefit or be indirectly harmed by legislation that could directly and substantially harm or benefit the financial interest of a person who is listed in E3A through D, the prohibition explicitly covers only benefit or harm to those persons who were listed. And then it says, however, and I think we should change that word to say, because, quote, legislator, unquote, is not listed, comma, and then turn the page, AS 2460.030(e)(3) does not explicitly prohibit a legislator from taking or withholding official action or exerting official influence when the sole effect of doing so could substantially benefit or harm the financial interest of the legislator and not a person listed in E3A through D. So if you go back and look on page 4 at the statute, it doesn't say financial interest of a legislator. It says of a person who's a member of their family, by whom they're employed or a member of their immediate family is employed, with whom they're negotiating for employment, or from whom they or a member of their family has, in the immediately preceding 12-month period, received more than $10,000 of income.
Mr. Wayne?
Yeah, sure.
Just a question, though. Wouldn't it still apply if it affected a legislator, if these people are immediately part of their household, if it affected the household? I mean, it would have an impact on those, because the financial impact, at least in a shared household, would imply it would have a harmful effect on those who would share it, wouldn't it?
Senator Beck, through the chair, that's correct. And that the way it's written, it has to do with it targets basically indirect benefits, or how can I put this? But if you wanted to clearly say that you were talking about substantial benefit or harm to the financial interest of legislators, you would say that. You would say substantially benefit or harm the financial interest of a legislator or a person who's a member of the legislator's family and so forth, but it doesn't say that. So sure, all those things on A through C can have an indirect effect on the legislator's financial interest, but it doesn't really approach it that way. This is, you know, it's very complicated, so that was a good question.
Yes, Representative Hannum. Through the chair. Mr. Wayne, could you just repeat when you said your suggestion would be, and I was trying to scribble it down and didn't keep up with you as I flipped the page. You said delete, however, replace with because.
Yes. Thank you. Through the chair, on the bottom of page 5, the very last word in the bottom paragraph says however, and I'm suggesting that we should cross that out and say because, quote, legislator, unquote, is not listed, comma, and then go on with it as written.
Thank you.
And I think it's just a place where, you know, it's one too many howevers, and it's more clear if we put in that other language. And, you know, I read this opinion again this morning after having drafted it over a month ago, and, you know, I saw a lot of things that I didn't see before, and that's what happens with drafting. So, and I'm sure there's going to be more.
Dan, I have a question for you.
Yes.
Does this statement here in any way affect the previous two advisory opinions that were issued that dealt with this particular issue, or with any statements in those advisory opinions? Is it contrary to anything in the other two, the one in 2018 and the one we approved in January?
Madam Chair, I don't know of any. But I haven't gone through line by line to see if it's in conflict. But I looked at them, and it didn't seem like that it really did. So
I guess my suggestion would be that I think they should be reviewed, because mm-hmm. I was not under this impression when the first two advisory opinions were mm-hmm. issued with this statement here. And so I feel in order to be consistent, if you could take a look at those other two and get back to Jerry, who could then get back to me, we can take a look at that. I just want to make sure that they're all
absolutely. And also, you know, if Jerry looks through them and finds anything, he can always let me know as well. So
right. Or if any of the committee members review yeah. the other two advisory opinions and have any comments relating to this mm-hmm. particular statement, let Jerry know, and we'll work on it. Because I feel this is new information for me from the last mm-hmm. two advisory opinions. And not that I would have been focusing on this, but I didn't pick that up in the other two advisory opinions. Connor Thomas.
Let me just try to be clear about your question. You know, the statement that you're concerned about is that it doesn't impact legislators?
Yes, that's okay. Correct. Yes, that's correct. The statement that we just made, the minor changes on. Any other questions from committee members? Okay, Dan Wynn. Senator Coghill.
Dan, thank you for bringing this to light. So the exception is in G or while participating in these three things, right? So I don't think we caught that along the way. And so it looks to me like these exceptions then take a whole different light than we had been thinking about them before, because we were thinking it was a direct prohibition on doing anything public or private, but it looks like we've created an exception the way it's worded here. And I think that is a new wrinkle to the way we've been thinking about it. So,
through the chair, it's still a direct prohibition, but it's targeting the financial interests of people on that list A through D, some of which indirectly affect the financial interest of a legislator, but it doesn't directly target the financial interest of a legislator, because the legislator isn't listed in that.
Right.
Right.
But it's still a direct prohibition on official action.
Right. Okay.
Okay.
Then it is the way I understood it, and I think the way you said it the first time, I'm thinking, oh man, this exception goes broader than I thought. But what you said clarified that, because in doing some of the reset, we went back to putting it all on the legislator again. Inartfully, got it, but we're trying to figure out how do we get the legislator under the microscope rather than the family. So, okay, all right, got it.
Yeah, Senator Coghill, through the chair, there's at least two other places in this big draft that we're looking at where we're going to sort of revisit this question. So hopefully by the time we get through that, some of you will be able to sort of get your head around this idea that legislator is not on that list. It was difficult to understand for me as well. Other conflicts of interest are not covered by
Dan. Just a second, if I could just put on the record, Senator Begich had to leave. I just want on the record that he has left the meeting for a short period of time.
I think we were on page 6, the second paragraph. Other conflicts of interest are not covered by AS 2460-030E3. For example, it applies only to a financial interest, which is defined in A990A6 as financial interest means ownership of an interest or an involvement in a business, including a property ownership or a professional or private relationship that is a source of income or from which or as a result of which a person has received or expects to receive a financial benefit. And that's important because the term financial interest is used in E3, and it's only those that are targeted by E3. We also note as a preliminary matter that 2460-030E3 contains two exceptions, the first allowing participation in public discussion or debate, and an exception for voting. We advised in AO 1901 that the exception for voting encompasses signing a committee report on a bill after voting on the bill in a committee meeting. Our reasoning with regard to the voting exception was based on language in AS 2460-030E3 saying that except as provided in G of this section, and language in 2460-030G of this section requiring a legislator with a conflict of interest to declare the conflict of interest, quote, before voting on a question before a committee of the legislature. We advise that with respect to a committee vote, that before voting implies that once the legislator declares a conflict, the legislator may vote, and signing the committee report on the legislation after the vote is allowed because the signing is a part of the voting. So now we finally get to question number one. Should a legislator with a conflict declare a conflict on the record when the bill will harm the financial interests of the legislator or the legislator's immediate family? So this is the same question that was asked in AO 1901 that the committee had answered previously. In this question, the words added are will harm, underlined. So the point being, well, we talked about benefit, but what about if it harms? And the rule says benefit or harm. So throughout the opinion, it just sort of clarifies that. Perhaps, maybe too much, but every question has that in it. So, that's how we've drafted it. Depending on applicable facts in a particular matter, the answer may be yes or no to this question. AS 2460-030G requires a legislator with a conflict of interest to declare the conflict before voting on a question before a committee of the legislature and to request to be excused from voting on a question before a house of the legislature. AS 2460-030G does not require a legislator to declare conflict on the record at any other time. Regardless of whether the action or influence may benefit or may harm the financial interest at issue, if the conflict is one described in E3, the legislator may not take or withhold official action or exert official influence except to vote or to participate in a public discussion or debate. In AO 1901, we advise that even when a legislator with a conflict under E3 is permitted by E3 to participate in a public discussion or debate, we recommend that the legislator declare the conflict of interest anyway, even for the limited purpose of discussing the matter. Depending on the facts, in some instances a failure to declare it when discussing the matter may create an appearance of ethical impropriety that undermines the Act's goal of assuring the trust, respect, and confidence of the people of the state. In other words, I think what was meant by that is that people watching might not, you know, understand all the nuances of the Ethics Act and might just feel like, well, how come they didn't say anything? Everybody knows that person, you know, has some sort of a conflict here. So, and I think legislators already do that anyway, but anyway. Question two, can a legislator with a conflict sponsor or co-sponsor a bill when the bill will harm the financial benefit, the financial interest of the legislator or the legislator's immediate family? The answer is no. If the bill will substantially benefit or harm the financial interest of a person who's a member of the legislator's immediate family under E3, as we advised in 1805 and 1901, a legislator's introduction or sponsorship of legislation is always discretionary. Because the uniform rules never require a legislator to introduce or sponsor legislation. It's something they would choose to do. Choosing to do so in spite of a conflict of interest would be contrary to the goals of the Act as set forth in 2460-010. Moreover, sponsoring or co-sponsoring legislation of any kind when you have a conflict requires taking official action or exerting official influence beyond participating in discussion or debate or voting. It may require the legislator to make formal motions, file paperwork, and in most instances request research, drafting, and other assistance by legislative employees. If the legislator has a bill-related conflict under E3, the legislator is prohibited from taking or withholding official action on the bill other than participating in a public discussion, debate, or voting. And so if I haven't already stressed it enough in this paragraph, this is only talking about bills where the legislator has a conflict under E3.
Madam Chair, just grammatically, I think at the beginning of that, it might be clearer to say no, comma, not if the bill will. You've got a sort of a phrase there that's not a sentence when you start that one with if. So if it started out saying no, comma, not if the bill will substantially.
Okay.
Through the chair, I think that's a good point. Question three. During a public committee meeting, can a legislator with a conflict participate in discussion, debate of the bill, advocate for the bill, and testify on the bill when the bill will harm the financial interests of the legislator or the legislator's immediate family? AS 2460-030E3 allows a legislator to discuss, debate, advocate, or testify on a matter where the legislator has a conflict of interest under E3, quote, while participating in a public discussion or debate, end quote. And it's citing Advisory Opinion 1901.
And at this point, I would like to, Dan, make a suggestion and write the word yes there, because all of the other questions either say no or yes. This one does not really have a yes. So I thought that would be easier to add that to the beginning. So just yes, period.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Moving on to question four, can a legislator with a conflict discuss or advocate for the bill during private meetings with other committee members when the bill will harm the financial interests of the legislator or the legislator's immediate family. Like a caucus meeting, a private meeting between two or more members of a legislative committee is not public. Therefore, although the answer to your question may depend on the applicable facts in each instance, generally the answer is no. A legislator with a conflict under E3 relating to a bill may not discuss or advocate for the bill during private meetings with other committee members, regardless of whether the bill will benefit the financial interest at issue or harm the interest. And that sentence, that last sentence, I think that there might be a way to make that read better. I found it.
You say benefit or harm.
I was thinking we could say benefit the financial interest at issue or harm them. Well, I guess it's okay the way it is. I don't know, unless somebody wants to change it. Number five, can a legislator with a conflict discuss or advocate for the bill during private meetings with other legislators that are not on the committee, including legislators in the other body, when the bill will harm the financial interest of the legislator or the legislator's immediate family? No, although it may depend on applicable facts in each situation. We would probably consider the discussion or advocacy to be exerting official influence under 030E3, which prohibits taking or withholding of official action or exerting official influence that could substantially benefit or harm the financial interests of a person under E3A through D. If so, exceptions in AS 2460-030E that might otherwise allow the legislator with the conflict to exert official influence do not apply. In other words, it's just another way of saying that official influence is treated exactly the same way as official action, even though it might mean something different for purposes of the prohibition. If you can't exert official action, then you also can't exert official influence. In our response to question 3C of AO 1805, we advise that a legislator with a conflict of interest under AS 2460-030E3D may not, except while participating in a public discussion or debate or voting in accordance with 2460-030G, take or withhold official action or exert official influence that could substantially benefit or harm the financial interest of a person from whom the legislator or a member of the legislator's immediate family has, in the immediately preceding 12-month period, received more than $10,000 of income. Accordingly, we advised in AO 1805 and later in our reply to question 4 in AO 1901 that a legislator with a conflict of interest under E3D would, in an informal or non-public discussion, be prohibited from taking any official action or exerting official influence, including advocating for the bill. The same would be true of other types of legislation in addition to bills, amendments, I suppose, would be another example of another type. But again, all this is only if the legislator has a conflict to begin with. So, for example, if I'm a legislator and my spouse, you know, works in education, and it's an education bill, it may not necessarily do what's listed here in E3, benefit a person by whom my spouse is employed. It may or may not. It just depends on the facts. Or it may not necessarily benefit a person who, from whom my spouse has an immediately preceding 12-month period received more than $10,000 of income. In both cases, it's my spouse's employer. Maybe the bill doesn't have any effect on them at all. Maybe it does. But just because something is an education bill doesn't necessarily take it off the table for me to discuss it privately if I'm a legislator in that situation. Therefore, based on the facts you've...
Representative, thank you. Through the chair, since you brought up that example, and I would, is the $10,000 of income that under E3D is specified as 10,000, is that what the substantial benefit of financial interest is? Is that the threshold we use in the others? So is my family's conflict of being substantial, is $10,000 the threshold we use in all four of those examples?
Well, we have a term, the term substantially benefit or harm,
right,
and it's defined. And I don't remember what the definition is. I don't think it's in this. We haven't gotten to it yet if it's in here, but I can look it up.
So in the through the chair, if I could ask a follow-up. So the example you gave, your spouse is an educator. Let's put them in the classroom as a teacher. And it's reform of reading standards. If the threshold of benefit or harm to the individual teacher would not be financial, and rarely could I think of a legislation that would benefit a teacher or harm a teacher $10,000 individually, then there would be no conflict because it's not of a substantial financial benefit or harm.
Through the chair, I mean, that's accurate because it only targets things that substantially benefit or harm the financial interest of, in that example, the employer of the teacher, the school, or this maybe the school district, if you could go that far up, I think. And let's see. Does anybody remember what question we were on? I'm sorry, Madam Chair.
Number five.
You were at the top of page 10.
Right.
Okay. We're halfway through.
Dan?
Yes.
Madam Chair.
Oh, go ahead, Senator Coghill.
The substantial benefit or harm does have a definition, and I'm going to read it to you real quick just to refresh our mind on it. It's in J2 of 2460.030. Means the effect of the person's financial interest is greater than the effect on the financial interest of the general public of the state. So that's not a threshold, that's a methodology. So the threshold is really $10,000 on one end, but the substantial benefit or harm is a scale. So that's just something to think about when we talk about it. That makes it very subjective, that's all.
And through the chair, I think that you know, hearing that definition and then thinking about also the definition of financial interest that also applies to E3, it's just another reason why it can be so helpful to ask for informal advice from the Ethics Committee when you think you might have a conflict, because if they walk you through and apply each one of these filters and definitions, in most cases they might be able to easily answer your question about whether you have a conflict just by saying, well, it's not financial, or and so forth. So, it can be complicated, especially when interpreting the Ethics Act isn't your usual job. But there's people around who can answer questions. Therefore, based on the facts you have provided, I'm back on page 10 now with second paragraph. During a private meeting with one or more legislators that are not on the committee, a legislator with a conflict under AS 2460.030(E3) that relates to a piece of legislation may not take or withhold official action or exert official influence on that legislation, including discussing or advocating for the legislation, even with the legislators who are from the other house of the legislature. Because it would be official action, and the legislator has a conflict. Number six, can a legislator with a conflict discuss or advocate for the bill during private meetings with constituents or generally other citizens when the bill will harm the financial interests of the legislator or the legislator's immediate family? Although the answer to this question may depend on the applicable facts in each instance, generally the answer is no, for reasons explained in our responses to questions 4 and 5 above. And here I would insert the word, I would start the next sentence by crossing out A and inserting the, referring to the legislator that the question is asking about. In other words, the legislator you have described. So we just say the legislator's discussion of or advocacy for or against proposed legislation in any kind of meeting would probably constitute official action, official influence, or both. And because the meeting you have described is private, not public, the public discussion or debate exception in AS 2460-030E3 would not apply. However, in some instances, discussion of a matter may or may not be considered official action depending on the applicable facts. For example, absent applicable facts indicating otherwise, we would not presume that a legislator's private discussion of pending legislation with a family member is official conduct related to the development, drafting, consideration, sponsorship, enactment, or defeat, support, or opposition to, or of a law amendment, resolution, report, nomination, or other matter affected by legislative action or inaction. That's the notice I've cleverly put in the definition of legislative action there. Maybe that wasn't a good idea, but that's what the footnote leads to below. Because the legislator would be acting in a personal, non-legislative role. So here in the draft, it distinguishes between, tries to distinguish between things that are, you know, just not related to your job as a legislator and things that are. And therefore, we typically would not find that it constitutes official action. On the other hand, a legislator's private discussion of pending legislation with a person who's a registered lobbyist, in another example, a legislative employee, or another legislator, might be presumed to be official action, absent facts indicating otherwise. And it might be presumed by the committee or by someone who's just, you know, member of the public. It's like, I just saw that legislator go into a room with a lobbyist, you know, and, you know, they had a copy of HB XYZ in their hand. So I presume that there's taking some official action in that room, and maybe that's not true. But if it's, if you see them going in with somebody who's a family member, it's not as easy to jump to that presumption, because there could be a lot of other reasons they're going in the room besides discussing legislation, you know.
Senator Coggle, do you have a question?
Just going to reiterate the question that anybody watching has to ask and the question that the legislator has to ask has three major parts to it. Is it official action? Is it a substantial financial interest? And what is that financial interest? And I'm going to read the definition of financial interest again. Remember that this has to always be on your mind when you're going into a private meeting. So the financial interest says an ownership of an interest or an involvement in a business, including a property ownership or a professional private relationship that is a source of income or from which a result of which a person has received or expects to receive a financial benefit. You have to be thinking about all of your relatives while you're going into the room, thinking these three things. So I'm just bringing that up to show how complex it gets, and just to reiterate your point at the very outset, how do you have to have this filter before you on every meeting you have on any influential issue that you have to deal with? And that's why this has become so problematic to me. So just, I'm just bringing it up as a matter of, because of what you said there, it's three things you have to keep in mind all the time: who's watching, what you're doing, and what these two definitions are.
And through the chair, Senator Coghill, that's true. On the other hand, if you know right from the very second, first second that you focus your mind on it, that it has nothing to do with anything financial at all, then you don't have to go through that whole definition to see if it, you know, meets it or not. It's like, we're not here, this isn't something where there's any financial element to it at all. I don't have to do that analysis. So if you reach any one of those points, then you close the book. because once that condition isn't, or that point isn't part of the equation, then you can say, okay, well, this whole thing doesn't apply to this conversation. So, and the disadvantages, if it looks like if it's a close question, then yeah, you have to kind of go through everything and evaluate a lot of complicated language. But if you reach any point in that calculation where it doesn't apply, then you don't have to go through the rest of it.
And Madam Chair,
I just want to point out Senator Begich is back on the record there in the meeting room.
And we don't want to belabor this, but you're right. We deal with a lot of policy calls that could answer that question, but we deal with a budget that has an exception except for these financial interests. And so that's the ambiguity that we have to wander through, because you have to know everything about that budget in order to make sure that you have not affected a financial interest of a significant other or a family member. So,
and through the chair, Senator Coghill, that's correct, although there is an exception. I suppose it only applies to voting
right.
on the floor for voting on budget bills.
Yeah, the financial interest, Madam Chair, is still the primary question.
And Dan, I have a suggestion. I know when we were talking at the top of page 10 on the third line where we said the line that starts says harm the financial interest, do you think it might be appropriate to put a footnote after the word financial interest with the definition of really what it is in the is it farther in the advisory opinion? And I just didn't.
Well, there's the definition is set out early on the introductory.
Number 9 on page 16.
On page 6.
What's on page 6? Okay,
yeah,
no
you could
problem.
Refer
I got
back
it.
To it.
Thank you.
And page
6. I forgot it was there. Thank you. Okay, go ahead, Dan.
Before we proceed.
Yes, Representative Hannon.
Thank you, through the chair, and I apologize being the new person. And I know that the confusing elements are on the tied to the financial, but I guess I have an underlying question, which is, are there no longer conflicts of interest that are, if there isn't a financial interest, then there's not a conflict of interest? So let's say it's a criminal bill that would put someone in prison or release them from prison, substantially changing the punishment of a crime, and would harm or benefit my spouse or family, but it's not financial. So is that not a conflict of interest? This, I know that the financial elements is where the law has created ambiguity, and frequently in public testimony on some hearings of appointees for the governor, people throw around the term conflict of interest, and it isn't directly tied to financial, but you know, I think in people's broad minds, those are obvious conflicts of interest if someone your family would benefit from a decriminalization that released them from prison or a criminalization that would put them in there. And is that no longer part of a conflict of interest, or it's just clear that we don't need a legal opinion on it?
I think I would defer to Dan on answering that question. Dan?
Thank you, Madam Chair.
I hear you would like it. Sorry.
I think that most people would view the example that you've given as a case where someone has a moral dilemma or, you know, conflicting interest. But I don't think the Ethics Act necessarily really targets it. Certainly E3 doesn't. It's focused only on the financial. And I think the more the people get used to that idea, that they'll realize that, okay, you know, first question I got to think of is it money? Is there money involved? And if there's not, then I can ignore E3. And then is there a conflict of interest statute somewhere else? I can't think of one. I see Jerry Anderson across the way here. Maybe he can, because he fields a bazillion questions.
I think I can help a little with this. I'm the administrator for the Ethics Committee, and so I get lots of these questions. What immediately came to mind was 2460.030, same section that we're looking at, but A2. where you're using state resources for the private benefit of another person, that could be one where your example could fit in. And we've had lots of those that the committee has looked at, especially in a complaint situation where state resources are being used for a private benefit in different situations, not one specifically like you addressed to the committee as a hypothetical. But I think that would be the section that I would look to first. And so that whole 030 is prohibited conduct and conflicts of interest. And so, you know, when you look at that, you have to look at each section. We're dealing with only E3 and G with these advisory opinions, but all the other sections deal with conflicts of interest also. Lots of them are incorporated in those other sections.
And through the chair, if I can continue on, another section that might apply in that situation would be 2460.030 A2, where you can't use public funds or legislative resources for the private benefit of another person or the legislator or legislative employee. So there may be some provision in the Ethics Act somewhere that would apply to that situation, but E3 doesn't.
Connor Thomas.
Yeah, just to follow up on that a little bit, I will say that a few years ago we actually had that very issue that you're talking about with somebody, and we did analyze it under the section that Dan just mentioned in deciding whether or not there was a basis for an ethics violation.
So, Madam Chair, just to add to that.
Senator Coghill.
In 030I, we talked about administrative hearings. So we did broach that topic, how you may not be able to interject yourself with public resources for that private benefit. But it really centered around public hearings. And I get to be part of the reason for that decision. Because I was helping somebody with workers' comp issues, and we bumped right up to against where lawyers were paying public, private money, and we were helping, thinking we were being helpful. We got our hand slapped because we got right into the middle of a pay-for contest that we didn't even realize. And once we did that, we had to pull back. But Joyce can remember that. And that rule is in there for that very reason. That we wandered a little too far, and it became apparent that we were actually using public resources for private matters, and hence we got this rule in there.
And Dan, is it also possible that a thing of value might come into play in this particular question?
Well, it's a benefit or is a thing of value. They're
right,
the same thing.
Because that's kind of what we were looking at and what Senator Coghill was talking about. It became a thing of value. It was something that was provided to a, I try to be careful what I say, provided to a constituent based on what his legislative office was doing. So, I mean, the thing of, I guess I'm just saying the thing of value came into play here. I'm trying to be careful what I say.
And through the chair, the thing of value, a lot of people might think that means financial value, but it's part of the definition of benefit in the Ethics Act, includes thing of value, and it's can be something that's of value to a person. For example, a person's liberty from jail would be of value to them, and so it would be a thing of value. But back to this opinion, number six. No, I think we were on number six.
Mm-hmm.
So we're on page 11 now, I think. So this paragraph on the top of page 11 is kind of, you know, a lot of this opinion sort of goes over ground that the committee's gone over in the last two opinions that it approved, and it just repeats a lot of the same stuff with a few tweaks. This is new, and it's one way for the committee to sort of clarify and narrow the meaning of official action. By saying, you know, there's some situations where it just sort of depends on the facts. We're not going to, out of the gate, presume that something is official action when it's, you know, involving a member of your immediate family or, for example, or some other person who's has nothing to do with the legislature, or where the conversation has nothing to do with your role as a legislator. Just because you're in the building. Number seven, can a legislator with a conflict during the public committee meeting on a bill that will harm the financial interests of the legislator or the legislator's immediate family, A, offer amendments to the bill? No. As we found in AO 1901, while the offer of an amendment might occur during public discussion and debate, it is nevertheless official action or official influence prohibited by 2460.030E3. So just because there's a public discussion going on doesn't mean that anything that happens during that discussion is you're home free. If it can still be official action if it's an example is, you know, offering an amendment. A legislator's introduction or sponsorship of legislation is always discretionary because the rules never require a legislator to introduce or sponsor legislation, and choosing to do so in spite of a conflict would be contrary to the goals of the act set forth in 2460.010. Moreover, sponsoring an amendment or other legislation requires taking official action or exerting official influence beyond participating in the public discussion or debate on or voting. For purposes of this opinion, we assume as fact that, among other things, it would require the legislator to make at least one formal motion, and in most instances require the legislator to request assistance from staff to prepare the legislation. Most amendments and bills and things are prepared through the office that I work in, and that's done after someone requests it, and that request would be something, you know, that's official. And then there's this, so you have to, these are subparts of question seven. Subpart B is, could the legislator with the conflict vote on amendments offered by others during a committee hearing or a public discussion or debate? Yes. And then I put a comma, the legislator may vote. I'd suggest adding comma, the legislator may vote, period. The reason is, otherwise, you have to turn the page back and read the question again, and it just saves a little time. The prohibitions in AS 2460.030E3 against taking or withholding official action or official influence in certain instances are limited by the provision except as provided in G of this section, which requires legislators who have a conflict of interest to declare it before voting on a question before a committee of the legislature. We found in AO 1901 that the provision except as provided in G of this section is an exception to the prohibitions in 2460.030E3 that allows a legislator to vote on a question before a committee of the legislature even though the legislator has a related conflict of interest under 2460.030E3, so long as the legislator declares the conflict before they vote. C. Yes. Maybe we should put in the legislator may vote, or may vote on the motion, comma, like we did in the above, even though it adds extra words. For reasons explained in B of this question. A vote on a motion to move a bill from committee is a vote on a question before a committee of the legislature. D, sign the committee report with a recommendation, do pass, do not pass, amend, question mark. Yes, for reasons explained in B of this question. As we advised in AO 1901, signing the committee report is part of voting on a question before a committee of the legislature. Depending on applicable facts in a particular matter, it may also encompass other official action closely related to voting. So there, I mean, I guess I'm just, the idea was to leave the door open a little bit because we just can't anticipate every darn question that's going to come up. And I certainly couldn't because I don't work in this building. So I don't really know all the things that go on in committee hearings behind the scenes and how, what official actions are taken. And, you know, so I thought, well, someone's probably going to come up with another question saying, you know, well, you said we can sign the committee report. Can we do this? Oh, I didn't even know you guys do that stuff. Okay, well, let's see. I don't know. It just kind of leaves it open because there may be other things.
Senator Begich.
Just a nuance, Dan. Thank you, Madam Chair. The so I signed the report. I have a conflict. I've stated the conflict on the record. I participated in debate. I signed the report amend, and the chair then asks me, how would we amend this? I actually can't answer him, can I? Even though I've suggested amend as my question. I'm pretty sure from what you just said, I can't actually tell him how to amend it or suggest to him a way to amend it.
Senator Begich, through the chair, I think that would be part of the debate and discussion.
Hope it comes out, yeah.
If it's not in a public setting, if it's after the meeting and you're in the chair's office, then you'd be talking about a bill that you have a conflict of interest on under E3 that because of someone's financial interest being impacted by it or harmed in some way or benefited, and having a private discussion. It's no longer covered by the voting part, really, because you're talking about something that doesn't have to do with the voting. It's not really closely related to the vote, and it's not part of a public discussion. So you'd say, well, maybe we can take that up in the next meeting, I suppose, and talk about it there.
So, Madam Chair.
Yes, go ahead, Senator.
So I am free, though. I could easily say, and it was just I was ambiguous about it before, but I could say during the debate, if it were me, I would want to see this bill amended in this manner, as long as it's in the public debate and I've declared my conflict. And that I would just leave it at that and just hope that my colleagues were not were able to understand the explicit comments I was making. I can't judge for them, but.
Senator Begich, through the chair, I mean, ultimately that's for the committee to determine in a specific case, but I mean, based on the two opinions already adopted, 1805 and 1901, it seems like that's part of the discussion or debate. They said you can debate mm-hmm. and advocate, testify, mm-hmm. as long as it's in that meeting.
Yes, go ahead.
Lee Holmes, as a public member, I look at this legislation as long as you've stated your conflict and you're discussing it in a public forum, it's acceptable. What I, as a public member, don't want to see is a legislator with a conflict discussing the bill in private. And that would be my concern. As long as it's an open public discussion and the conflict is known, and it's up to the other legislators and the public to determine, you know, how they want to take that legislator's influence. And so in reading this bill, that's what I look at as a public member is it public? Or are they only discussing it in public? And they can discuss it to their heart's content in that public meeting, vote on it in the committee, and then when it gets to the onto the floor, if it moves that far, again, the conflict comes up. The rules may allow them to vote anyway, but at least the conflict is known. And so I see the thing more, the statement that I have a conflict is more important than anything else in this bill. And that's what I saw the bill as, is just defining when they need to state they have a conflict. And then after that, don't talk about it in private.
Madam Chair.
That sounds very clear.
Deb Fancher.
And I would, when I looked at this bill and I've read this and sat through the two meetings that everyone else has, as a legislator, which I am not, I think this would be incredibly difficult to work under, where you cannot talk a private education matter with someone on the education committee. I just think that this, Dan, I think that you've probably spent hours trying to interpret it. My hat is off to you for trying, but it just seems like legislation that needs to be modified, and it seems like that modification is coming down the pike. But as a public member, I want to go in and talk to my legislator who knows something about education. I don't want him to say we have to do this in a public matter. It just seems very cumbersome, difficult. Representative Hannah brought up a situation with a reading initiative. Well, I think that could be argued that that reading initiative would bring money to a school district. So that could be a financial matter. That would take that off the table. I realize that there has to be some logic applied to this. This just seems like very cumbersome and definitely in need of some modification.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. I want to get back to Senator Begich's question. So in other words, what you're saying, Dan Wayne, is if Senator Begich were during a committee meeting to say, not offer an amendment because you can't, but and say, gee, I would amend this to such and such because so forth, that's perfectly okay because it's part of the discussion and debate.
That's how I would, the answer I would give based on the two opinions that the committee has already adopted.
Right, and that's what I was under, I just wanted to restate that because we seem to have kind of lost a little bit, but that's the way I would look at it, and that's the way I would look at it based on the opinions as well, so I just wanted to restate that point.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
Just as an example, I recently removed myself from a bill after advice from Jerry as a co-sponsor on the floor of the Senate. I then, under unfinished business and under special, under both unfinished business and special orders, commented on the particular issue itself and why I supported that issue and why I encouraged my colleagues to support it, though I could not co-sponsor legislation dealing with it. And I felt that that is exactly what Dan has said, what Mr. Wayne has said, and follows exactly what Member Holmes has said is his expectation of the law. And so I think that identifies it, and I do believe that there's a fix that will look like something after we all mm-hmm. deal with it that passed the Senate and is going to the House now and will look different when it comes back, but I think it may address these issues mm-hmm. more directly.
And I was aware of that situation. Jerry had informed me of that as well. So. Okay, if there aren't any other questions, Dan, you want to move forward?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think we were on subsection E towards the bottom of page 12. Can the legislator sign the committee report? No recommendation. Yes, see answer to D of this question.
Before you go on, excuse me, this is Skip Cook. I had a little issue before you go on to 8. Back up in under B in the middle of the first paragraph, you sort of mixed your singulars and plurals, Dan.
Oh, no.
It says, which requires legislators who have a conflict of interest to vote on it. It should be, I think it would be better for that to read, which requires a legislator who has a conflict of interest to declare it.
Requires a legislator.
A legislator who has a conflict of interest. Otherwise, you've got, mm-hmm. you can change it to them instead of it, but I think it's better to make it singular.
Okay, thank you, Skip.
I've noted that change here. And, Madam Chair, continuing on with question number 8. According to Uniform Rule 24, committee reports are necessary to move a bill from committee and must be signed by a majority of the members of the committee. When a member has a conflict and the bill would harm the financial interests of the legislator or the legislator's immediate family, would the member have to abstain from signing the report or sign the report no recommendation in order to comply with the law? No. We advised in AO 1901 that signing a committee report with or without a recommendation is part of voting on a question before a committee of the legislature and therefore members not required to abstain from signing the report in order to comply with the rule. The answer is the same here. Regardless of whether the bill, and here I would change the sentence to read, may benefit the financial interest at issue or harm them. So we'd cross out result in A and cross out or A harm to, and then right before the period at the end of the sentence say or harm them.
May result.
And benefit. Just trying to underscore that difference between benefit and harm and answer the question more with more of a point on it.
Dan, would you read that again, please?
So the full sentence then would read, the answer is the same here, comma, regardless of whether the bill may benefit the financial interest at issue or harm them.
Thank you.
Also note that benefit or harm to the financial interests of the legislator may not be at issue in a scenario like the one you have described, depending on specific facts. As noted in our response to question 6 of this opinion, even if official action is taken or withheld or official influence exerted, the prohibitions in 2460.030(e)(3) do not apply unless the legislator has one or more of the four conflicts of interest under 2460.030(e)(3)(a) through D. E3 does not prohibit a legislator from taking or withholding official action or exerting official influence when the sole effect of doing so would be to substantially benefit or harm the financial interests of the legislator or person who's not listed in 2460.030(E3)(a)-(d). Number nine, what constitutes substantial harm to a legislator or a legislator's immediate family under 2460.030(e)(3)? The term substantial harm does not appear in E3 or elsewhere in the Act. In order for a prohibition under 2460.030(e)(3) to apply, the action or influence targeted by that provision must, quote, substantially benefit or harm, end quote, the financial interest of a person under subparagraphs A through D of that paragraph, including a member of the legislator's immediate family. For purposes of AS 2460.030, substantially benefit or harm means the effect on the person's financial interest is greater than the effect on the financial interests of the general public of the state. And cites the definition in J2 that Senator Coghill read a few minutes ago. Page 14, can a legislative committee sponsor a bill if the chairperson of that same committee is conflicted? Yes, if by conflicted you mean has a conflict of interest under AS 2460.030(e)(3). However, the bill's sponsorship by the committee does not relieve the chair from compliance with the Act, including E3 and 030G. For example, if the chair has a conflict of interest under E3, the chair can discuss and advocate for the bill in a public meeting or a floor session and vote on the bill or legislation related to the bill, but is prohibited from taking or withholding other official action. 11. Can an office of the chairperson carry a committee bill if the chairperson is conflicted? No. Carrying a committee bill would require the chairperson's office staff to take official action as directed by the chairperson, and the chairperson's direction of staff would constitute official action. Moreover, because the chairperson's office staff work directly for the chairperson, action taken by the staff with regard to the legislation would also constitute official action by the chairperson. They almost sounds like the same rule stated twice, but it is different, I think. I labored over that a little bit this morning, and I decided to leave it. Number 12. Can a legislator with a conflict request that Leg Legal draft a blank sponsor bill on the conflicted subject matter? No, requesting a legislative employee to draft a bill is an official action. Although official action is not defined by the Act, we've previously found the meaning to be broad enough to include legislative action, and then it goes through that definition again. As noted throughout this opinion and 1901, there's no exception in E3 allowing a legislator who has a conflict of interest under that section to take official action other than participating in a public discussion or debate or voting. 13, can a legislator...
Excuse me, I'd like to go back to 10 for a minute now that you've read 11 and 12.
Okay.
And the reason is that in 10, the question is, can a legislative committee sponsor a bill? But you're saying that the chairman, who would be the chairman of the legislative committee, would have a conflict if the chairman has a conflict of interest that they could not take any official action. So basically then that chairman would not be able to direct staff to draft the bill, way out reading it in 12. So that puts limits on the chairman of the committee to really operate that committee by not instructing the staff, you know, to go ahead and have legal draft. So I just want to make sure I'm reading that correctly.
Through the Madam Chair, it does present some practical issues for sure. If there's a way for a committee to sponsor a bill without the chairperson's office being involved in it, then I guess they can do it. But if there isn't, then they probably would have to find someone else to sponsor it.
Okay, and I'm not, I see Senator Begich has his hand up, but I'm not familiar enough with the committee process such as you, because we're not legislators or staff to legislators, as to how that works. But that was my question here, because when I got to 12, I went back to 10. saying, wait a minute, if the committee chair can't take any official action, then that means they can't do anything. So
legally they can, but yes, practically maybe they can't.
Right. So Senator Baker, maybe you can answer that for me.
I think I can, Madam Chair. Every committee elects a vice chair as well. And in this instance, the chair would say, you know, they would step from their position, and the vice chair acting in the position of the chair could easily ask for that legislation to be drafted as the acting chair, and they would cite the provision of the conflict with the ethics law, and that would be, at least from my understanding of our committee process, that would be completely acceptable.
Okay, well, that was
for elected vice chairs.
I didn't want to go there, but that was my thought, but I just wasn't sure how that would work if the chair of the committee couldn't.
It's
okay,
not
thank
an arbitrary
you.
Process on the committee, at least in the Senate, it's not an arbitrary process. It's actually elected vice chair, so it's not, you know, some random process, so I think that should reassure you to some degree.
Okay. And for the House members here, does that pretty much fall through with the House then, too? Representative Hannon?
The freshman always looks to defer to another member. But I serve on four committees, and not all of them have vice chairs. Mm-hmm. So that's the point where, well, to have co-chairs, one of those has a co-chair and a vice chair, but one committee has neither. So,
and I don't know what the difference between a vice chair and a co-chair. I mean, technically I do, but I'm not sure what it means for a legislative committee at
right.
this point.
Anybody in that committee could.
Right. Well,
the office could sponsor it. It doesn't have to be a chairman pushing the bill through.
No, and I guess.
But the question related to a legislative committee sponsoring a bill, so
right.
that's why I was working specifically on that point.
I do not know what the rules of
right.
you know, the regs are for what a committee can do. So,
right.
And as Senator Begich had pointed out, it was a member of the committee who was asking their staff to move it forward. So it just sounds like the committee needs to assign duties to individual members, and it's just the chairman's office cannot or will not be allowed to do that.
And I agree. I'm just making a point that when I got to 12, I'm thinking back to the committee itself, which the chairman had the conflict and wasn't able to, you know, gather all the information, have the bill drafted, and so forth and so on. So it sounds like there are options.
And I would throw in one more thing through the chair, that, you know, the functionality of why the conservative approach would be, if I were the chair and I am chairing a special committee, and there's a difference between special committees, and that's where we don't have a vice chair, versus a standing committee. But I guess I would always err on the side of, I'm conflicted, therefore I don't think my committee should be the sponsoring. Mm-hmm. And the practical matter is, procedurally, there isn't a real difference except for time frames, when individually sponsored legislation is no longer able to be entered, but committee sponsored legislation is. And that's where the pressure would be. We've now come to the conclusion we need a committee sponsored bill. It's too late for individual sponsorship. Okay. But I guess the more you read, the more concerned you become. And I think, you know, and this is easy to say as the freshman, because I haven't encountered the scenario where you became aware of it at a time frame where it's the committee you're on, that's where the bill is, you now realize you need a committee substitute because there's no other way to resolve it, that you would take the risk and go, somebody else needs to take this on. And I guess, you know, you're speculating about the hypotheticals that we haven't yet encountered, but I think it reinforces the point that Member Fancer made. The ethics reforms perhaps have created some downstream effects that we didn't anticipate being they were creating hurdles that really didn't resolve the problems we were after resolving, and we hope that they would be remedied before we get to a situation where the pertinent committee couldn't deal with the issue because of time constraints and chairmen's having conflicts.
I may be presumptuous, but I don't think that any legislative committee would cease to function simply because the chair was unavailable. Chair could be unavailable for illness or death, and surely the committee would elect some way to continue on with that committee's action. So I think it's covered.
I just want to make a point that it seemed like a conflict.
Well, through the chair, the dilemma is if I'm chairing a committee, I have a staff person who's staffed to the committee, and that's that piece where I'm conflicted. Therefore, my staff can't work on this either. It needs to be someone else. So even though I, for the day or a week, am gone and can't chair the meeting, I no longer would turn to my staff who'd say, you can't support this either because I'm conflicted out of it, and that applying to my staff being a resource that I'm in control of.
Okay, very interesting.
Yeah, through the chair. I think one thing a person in that situation can do is always try to look at it, you know, how will my actions be perceived by the ethics committee, by the public. I'm gone, my staff, the person who I directly supervise that works for me, is, you know, guiding this bill through in my absence. Is that going to look okay? Maybe it will. I don't know, but anyway.
Go ahead.
I think we're on question 13, page 15. Mm-hmm. Can a legislator with a conflict sponsor and or draft amendments in committee or on the floor? No, sponsoring or drafting an amendment in a legislative committee or floor session or anywhere else is an official action. As noted through this opinion and AO 1901, there's no exception in E3 that allows a legislator who has a conflict of interest under that section to take official action except for public discussion or debate or voting. Moreover, a legislator's introduction or sponsorship of legislation, including an amendment, is always discretionary. The rules don't require them to do it. And when a legislator has an ethical conflict of interest in a matter, the legislator's introduction of or sponsoring legislation on the matter is contrary to goals of the Act set forth in 2460.010. Number 14. Can a legislator with a conflict sponsor and or vote on amendments in committee or on the floor on the conflicted subject matter? If the conflict is under AS 2460.030(e)(3), the answer is yes with respect to voting on an amendment or other legislation in a committee meeting or floor session because there's an exception for voting. However, the answer is no with respect to sponsoring or drafting an amendment because it's an official action. And we kind of don't need to go read the rest of that. I don't think we've repeated it a few times. Question 15, can a legislator with a conflict request that Ledge Legal draft amendments before there has been a committee or floor session about the conflicted subject matter and before the legislator has been able to give public notice of the conflict? No, based on our response to questions 12 through 14 of this opinion. 16, can a legislator with a conflict hold a meeting in their office with a group that represents the topic of the conflict? Based on available facts and our answer to question 6 in this opinion, the answer to this question is no. Unless the applicable facts in a particular instance indicate otherwise, we will presume, as we do here, that a meeting like the one you've described is a private meeting. In the facts before us, the legislator has a conflict of interest under E3. The legislator already knows that. It's not, you know, there is a conflict. It's not some nebulous thing like, well, that, you know, it is in the education field and I have a, you know, son or daughter that's a teacher. They've already ascertained that they have a conflict. And therefore, except for voting on or while participating in a public discussion or debate, the legislator is prohibited from taking or withholding official action or exerting official influence, etc. Even if the persons with whom the legislator is privately meeting are not on that list under A through D, the legislator's conflict does not go away. So they already have a conflict. Someone's going to benefit on A through D is going to benefit their or have a substantially be substantially benefited or harmed. Their financial interests will be if the bill passes or fails. So then even if the people that they're meeting with in the room aren't going to, it's still an official action. It's prohibited the way this is drafted, at least. As we noted in our answer to question six, there may be instances where a legislator with a conflict under E3 can meet privately with certain persons and discuss the legislation causing the conflict. Those instances include circumstances where the legislator is clearly not acting in a legislative role and not taking or withholding official action or exerting official influence. However, we also noted that those instances generally do not include discussions with legislative employees, registered lobbyists, or other legislators, and we add to that list, quote, a group that represents the topic of the conflict, end quote. Another way to put that would be maybe special interest group. I think that's what most people would consider that to be. In those instances, there is a rebuttable presumption that the legislator is acting in a legislative role and holding the meeting as official action prohibited by 2460.3E3. Number 17, is it possible for a legislator to have a conflict 1 year, say 2017, and not have a conflict next year in 2018, and then have a conflict again in 2019? And then there's an example here. I'm not going to read that because you all have it in front of you about the guide. The answer is yes, depending on applicable facts in a particular instance, including the facts in your example, which we understand as describing a legislator who's also a commercial guide who makes over $10,000 guiding in 2017, doesn't make any money guiding in 2018, and then makes over $10,000 guiding for one employer in 2019, it is possible. The facts of your example are covered by E3D, which targets only, quote, more than $10,000 received, quote, in the immediately preceding 12-month period. If under those facts, 2018 is the 12-month period at issue, there's no conflict under E3D because there was no income in the 12-month period. However, it's important to note that a 12-month period and a calendar year are two different things. If the 12-month period immediately preceding the official action being considered were to straddle two calendar years, then under your facts, there may be a conflict under 2460.30E3D. Yes.
Lee, go ahead.
I had a question on this one in the response, which we understand is describing a legislator and commercial guide, but as described above, the financial aspect is for an immediate member of the legislator, not the legislator. So I assume that the guide was a son, a spouse, a wife, not the legislator. And so I thought we made the distinction that $10,000 does not apply to a legislator.
Yeah. I see what you're saying. It's through the chair. It's been a month or so since I drafted this, but I remember thinking that the guide is paid by the person who employs the guide. And so the conflict would be if that under E3D is, you know, a person who has employed the let's just read it. Okay, it's on page 4. Well, it starts on page 4. A legislator may not directly or by authorizing another to act on their behalf, take or withhold official action or exert official influence that could substantially benefit or harm the financial interest of a person, D, from whom the legislator or a member of the legislator's immediately family has in the immediately preceding 12-month period received more than $10,000 of income. So I was trying to apply that, and maybe it gets confusing because it sounds like we're talking about the legislator having a conflict because they made $10,000, and they kind of do because that's the basis of their relationship with the person whose financial interests are going to benefit as a result of the legislation. You know, the ABC Guide Dispatch Service or whatever that they that paid them the $10,000 in the preceding 12 months, you know, wants this bill to pass or fail because of the effect it's going to have on them. And this legislator is scurrying around trying to help make that happen, or at least the public views it that way, because it's going to benefit that company that paid them, you know, more than $10,000. $10,000 may not sound like a lot, but more than $10,000 could be $1 million. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that was the low threshold. The high threshold is limitless. So.
Yes, go ahead, Connor.
Connor Thomas, I had a question about this too. I assume that we're talking about the legislator who's the guy, but it wasn't clear to me whether or not he was employed by somebody else, and if he was, what about the other section that had to do with employment, regardless of whether or not he made income of $10,000 or not? I mean, there may be a conflict if there was some sort of a substantial benefit or harm to the employer.
Okay.
Correct?
Yeah, no, I think that this section needs some work. I think it should start off with explaining how the committee interprets the example. You know, we interpret this to mean that the $10,000 came from somebody that the legislator worked for, and that the conflict is under E3D because the person that the legislator worked for that paid him that money stands to benefit or gain or benefit or be harmed by this bill. And so,
but if he was employed, wouldn't be also a possibility? I mean, by whom the legislator or a member of the legislator's immediate family is employed, and you're not confined to the $10,000 there. It's whether or not there is a substantial benefit or harm, financial interest of a person. In this case,
right?
It just seems like I know this hypothetical is unclear, but it does seem like there's another area that might be relevant.
Okay.
Depending on the facts.
So we could analyze it under B, and then separately under
D.
D. Yeah.
Okay.
Because the question really isn't very clear.
No, it's not. I agree.
When questions aren't clear, then usually what I try to do is, you know, adopt some, put them in some form that's clear enough to answer, and say, you know, we interpret your question to mean this. And I guess we can use that device here.
And I think that would be good, because I was actually, as you were reading it, where you said legislator and commercial guide, my first thought was to say a legislator who is a commercial guide. But
yeah.
Then I looked back at the question, so I'm, you know,
it's clear.
It's confusing. Okay, so is there something you could draft for that, and then
not on the fly?
No, I don't mean on the fly. I didn't mean on the fly.
Because that would probably just end up creating problems.
Right. Yeah. So if there's something you could draft for those that are new members on the committee, what we've done in the past is we've had some conceptual thoughts that came up during the committee meeting and were added to the advisory opinion, but they were sent out to the committee for review before final. Connor?
Yes, that brings up another question. I was going to wait till the end, but you know, your comment earlier with respect to comparing this to the other ones, is it your hope that we take a vote on this today, or do you want to, after we're done with this analysis, to hold off until we have a chance to analyze this opinion with the other two that you mentioned?
Well, I throw that out for discussion for the committee and maybe comment from Dan. I do feel, based on my comments, that we need to look at the other two.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I think that's a good idea.
Yes. So if we go through this and it's the committee's wish to hold this for the next meeting, we could, realizing, of course, that this is a legislative session and everything is moving forward, and they may need some guidance. I mean, there's issues on both sides. So I'll throw it out for discussion. Deb, you look like you want to say something.
I usually want to say something. You know, that's a problem with being a teacher. But I, you know, I feel like the freshman member of the Ethics Committee. I would like to see, I too, Joyce, when you brought up things from the previous discussion. I would like to see that beside this, as well as things that Mr. Begich or Senator Begich referred to coming down the pike, and also look at that as well.
Okay, well, I think what's coming down would not really affect what's in here, because this is based on current statute.
Okay.
So I think that would be not part of the equation that we would be looking at.
No, not on this.
Okay. No. Yes, Lee Holmes.
I think that we almost have a duty to try to move forward with putting this responses out there, and where we have issues where we're just asking for some clarification, like on this response to number 17. I would recommend that we do look at voting on these today, because it may have an impact on what Senator Begich said, which is potential legislation changing House Bill 44's terminology. And I think knowing our opinion on how we view some of these may allow them a better understanding of what they need to do, or what language we may or may not find appropriate in the new bill as well. So I see this as not only a guideline, but also potentially affecting legislation which is moving through the legislature right now.
Okay.
Madam Chair, may I?
Dan, go ahead, please. Yeah.
You know, I have 1805 and 1901 with me, and I just looked through 1901 briefly, but, you know, it addressed each question, and it addresses each question by talking about a legislator who has a conflict under E3.
Mm-hmm.
So, and there's no facts presented. There's no discussion of facts where, you know, does a legislator have a conflict under E3 if they, you know, work on a fishing boat and they, you know, it's not really like that. It just, the answers say, if a legislator has a conflict under E3, then they can't vote here, or they can't do this, or they can't. And so I don't think it's in conflict with this opinion. That one isn't. And I have 1805, and I could probably say the same thing about that, but I'd like to look at it first.
Counselor Thomas?
Yeah. Well, you know, I don't disagree with Lee Holmes' position. It seems to me that we're going to have to get some clarification on, at least for number 17, and as you said, what we've done before is send these out and say, are you okay with this? And I don't see why we couldn't do the same thing with your analysis, Dan's analysis of the two opinions. In other words, he could just tell us at that time, yeah, there is no conflict, or there is. So in other words, we could vote and do what we've done in the past, which is, you know, have additional language that comes in afterwards.
Okay, Skip Cook?
Well, another thing would be to go ahead and just say, in this opinion, we are asking for clarification and sort of do that as a supplemental opinion later if we want to.
You mean for that question?
Just to pull that question out and approve the rest of it would be another way to do it.
Yeah.
And you're right, we could say the question is ambiguous. We are not clear as to what the, who's related to, you know,
it'll be considered by
the commercial guide. The legislator, not the legislator, a family member, and so forth. I mean, we could make a statement stating we're not clear on that, and then issue the rest of the opinion.
We
could do that.
Madam Chair, another thing we could do is say, you know, we don't really understand how this example would apply, but we could leave in the part about 12-month periods, and because that's generic, it applies.
We could do that.
I mean, I really think the essence of the question is not so much the example as this thing about how 12-month periods, just asking for a clarification of that, and we can just kind of get really complicated by this, you know.
Mm-hmm. Okay,
are they really asking about a guy, you know, does someone really want to know, you know, I'm a guide and I would like to know if it's okay for me to do this, or is it just an example? I don't know.
Well, you're right, we could say the relationship between the legislator and the guide are unclear, so we won't answer that part, but here is the generic answer to the 2017, 2018, 2019 year.
Yeah, here's how 12-month period applies.
I like that.
Yeah.
And that's pretty much already done here. We can just cross some of this out and add a sentence saying.
Okay. Is the committee okay with that?
More to go.
Okay, well, why don't we go ahead and have Dan redraft that particular part, and then we will send it out to the committee for approval. We always do that anyway for those that are new in the committee whenever we've made any changes, like we've made some little grammatical changes in here and so forth. What we would do is we will send it out to the committee for them to review that as well. So when that comes, you need to let Jerry know that you're in agreement with the changes that were made. So we'll go ahead and do that with this section. Okay, why don't we move along to 18? Or do we have another question, Jerry?
I'd like to just make a comment that, you know, the process that we're using here today is one of a public process because there was specific grant of waiver of confidentiality. And so, you know, this doesn't normally happen with the Ethics Committee on these advisory opinions that they're discussed in executive session, but because there was that waiver of confidentiality that we can go ahead and discuss that here today. Specifically, there's a person here today that can help clarify the intent of that question, if that would help the committee. And I guess perhaps to hear from him, because it is in that process, is appropriate. And that would be Chad Hutchinson, who can help us with that if the committee would like to hear from him.
I will throw that out to the committee instead of making a decision myself. Do you want clarification on the question, or would that be helpful?
I would.
That's fine.
Okay. Well, Chad, if you want to come forward and state your name and who you work for on the record, and then go ahead.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Chad Hutchinson. I'm the Senate Majority Counsel. I drafted this question at the behest of one of the senators, and I can tell you the intent was the legislator himself was the commercial guide.
Okay. All right. Go ahead, Connor.
Is he employed by somebody, or do you know the answer to that?
Through the chair, he's a commercial fisherman, actually, so we changed the facts a little bit, but commercial guide, commercial fisherman, mm-hmm. and during the summer, sometimes he makes over $10,000, sometimes he doesn't. Depends on what's fishing.
So he's fishing for himself, though?
Correct.
Okay.
But he makes over $10,000. He can during certain summers, so that's why that question was posed.
Okay.
So Dan, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Atkinson.
Can I ask?
Yes, go ahead, Representative.
So is he a commercial fisherman or a commercial fishing guide?
Through the chair, he is a commercial fisherman in reality, but for the purposes of this question, we just chose commercial guide and, you know, interchangeable, but whether he made $10,000 in the summer or not, that's the real question that we're trying to get to.
Madam Chair.
And Dan, is it okay with us to go with commercial guide versus being more definitive? I don't see a problem with commercial guide.
I don't see a problem with commercial guide if we can establish that it's self-employed. You know, I guess
you could write your thing to assume that now, right?
Mm-hmm. Assume, well, self-employed, then yeah.
That's what self-employed is, correct?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, we can add that it is the legislator then, and that it is self-employment.
And so it won't. They don't have a conflict, and you know, and we can still explain how the 12-month period works,
right?
Just so that people know.
Yeah. Well, this answer holds up.
Yes. Yeah, okay. All right. Yeah. So we will add that in the answer. Can we put in the answer? We've not really done this before. I think we should put in the answer that we received clarification during the committee meeting that the legislator is the commercial guide and self-employed.
Yeah, that's fine.
I think we should start out with that.
We should do that.
Yes, we'll start out with that and then answer the question. Okay. Thank you, Mr. Hutchinson. Okay, why don't we go on to 18, unless there are further clarification we need for 17. We'll let just Dan redraft that a little bit and get it out to the committee.
Okay. Does a legislator have to declare a conflict if they think they'll make over $10,000 in the upcoming year? For example, the summer of 2019, if they're reviewing 2019 legislation directly related to the activity the legislature anticipates earning the money over $10,000 from. No, absent additional facts and based on our responses to question 8 of this opinion, the legislator in the circumstances you describe would not have to declare a conflict of interest under 030E3 because only the legislator's financial interest would benefit. Therefore, the legislator would not have a conflict of interest under E3. However, nothing in the Act would prohibit the legislator from mentioning the potential benefit to the legislator's financial interest, if only to forestall concerns that may arise if someone else knows of that potential benefit and misperceives the legislator's conduct as a violation of the Act. Again, some people may not make the, you know, some of the distinctions that the committee makes in interpreting the Act if they haven't read all these opinions and feel like it should have been mentioned. And so a person can just avoid a whole lot of trouble by mentioning it, or they can, they're free not to. The conclusion is pretty much what we had in 1901. Do you want me to talk about that, or?
And I think that's appropriate, because normally in the conclusion we try to recap the questions, but there were so many questions and so many different.
Yeah, I didn't recap them here.
I think this is appropriate in this particular advisory opinion.
Madam Chair, can I just say one more thing about 1805 and 1901 and whether they conflict with this?
Yes, go ahead.
Okay. First of all, if they do, and I don't think they do, but if they did, then the remedy, I guess, would be to reissue those opinions, corrected in some way. And you could say, you know, in to be consistent with 1902, we're correcting this opinion to clarify that it doesn't apply to legislators' financial interests. But in just going through both of them, it looks like they were written in such a way that it just doesn't, they're not in conflict. So.
And I have them with me as well. I may just take a look at them later. I brought them, but I did not.
If anyone sees anything, you know, then that would be the thing to fix. But I don't think that necessarily anything would need to be done with this opinion to address that. Because if there is a conflict, it's not evident to me. I don't know.
Well, I would suggest that you take a more thorough look at it after you get later today or tomorrow or whatever. And cursory, it looks good. So we'll go with that. And then we'll wait to hear from you if there's anything in there that you didn't see during the committee meeting that you saw later. Okay, I think we are at a point where we've gone through this advisory opinion. I believe it might be the first one we've ever had this many pages, even though this is a draft, 18 pages. So are there any further comments, discussions from committee members regarding the opinion before we move forward in a possible vote? Connor Thomas. No,
well, I'm going to move to adopt advisory opinion 1902 as amended during the discussion. So.
Okay. All right. Any further discussion? Okay. If there's no further discussion, we are required to have a roll call vote for advisory opinions. So, Jerry, if you want to take a roll call vote and maybe just read real quickly what you've put together for a synopsis of the advisory opinion so we have that on record.
In accordance with our rules of procedure, I'm going to read just a quick summary on that formal advisory opinion. AO 1902 advises whether specific actions, including to take or withhold official action or exert official influence and declaring a conflict and voting, are proper under AS 2460-030 ENG in specified situations and the definition of substantial harm, and whether a legislative committee or the office of a conflicted chair of a committee may sponsor legislation in a situation where the chair of the committee is conflicted, and other specific details of situations where a conflict is present under AS 2460-030E. Roll call vote is to concur or not concur with the draft opinion. As amended here in committee discussion, a vote of yes will be a vote to concur with the draft opinion. A vote of no will be to not concur with the draft opinion. With that roll call vote, alternate Representative Sarah Hannon.
Yes.
Representative Delana Johnson.
Yes.
Member Skip Cook.
Yes.
Member Connor Thomas.
Yes.
Member Joyce Anderson.
Yes.
Member Deb Fancher.
Yes.
Member Lee Holmes.
Yes.
With that, I note that Senator Coghill and Senator Begich have both not been able to remain here for this vote, so I'm showing a vote of 7-0 to concur with the draft opinion as amended in committee action here today.
All right, thank you. So the opinion has passed. We will put down for Senator Coghill and Senator Begich absent. I think what we may have done in the past is present for part of the discussion, or do we just want to say absent for the vote? We just want to say absent? Dan, what have we done in the past? Have we?
I can't remember if we said absent from. We could say members absent from the vote, or I don't know. I can look it up and see if we.
I guess what I'd like to do is make some sort of notation. I can't recall myself what we've done when the legislators are here for the majority of the discussion, but unable to be here for the vote.
Members are, who are present, we'd say members who were present for discussion, but abstained. Well, they didn't really abstain from voting. They were just, and just say absent during voting.
Right. I think we should put that on both.
And then just list them out and just list their names and their affiliation.
All right. Let's go ahead and do that with that. All right. Okay, we are moving forward slowly but surely. We are now under advisory opinion. 1903 is not available, so that is not in your packet. We are now going to advisory opinion 1904.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
I'll start.
Yes. Advisor opinion 1904 also the end of, was waived confidentiality, so that's why we are hearing it during a public meeting. So go ahead, Dan.
Tab F for committee members.
Thank you.
Okay, I'm going to add in, I didn't add in the part about waiving confidentiality. So on.
Madam Chair, can I?
Yes. Ms. So Representative.
The date on the top of it is February 2018.
Mm-hmm. That is the day of the draft.
Okay.
So it will be changed to today's date as approved today.
Yeah, it's just a typo.
Oh, okay. That's what my question was, whether it's a typo or whether this is a question from a year ago.
No, I shouldn't say.
Oh, I didn't catch that. I'm sorry. Okay. I thought you were talking about the previous one.
And
no, it should say 2019. And
Madam Chair, let me clarify. It's a drafting error, not a typo. I'm responsible for it. It was my mistake.
Okay. Thank you. I just I thought I knew what the hell how you numbered these, and then I thought, oh, the question pens for a long time.
Okay. Good point.
So starting on page one, somewhere in that first paragraph, I need to add a sentence saying you've waived confidentiality.
Okay, we'll make that as an addition.
The questions presented, number one, does the act prohibit a legislator who works part-time for an employer who paid the legislator less than $10,000 in the immediately preceding 12-month period from meeting privately as a legislator with that employer? Number two, does the act permit a legislator who has a conflict of interest under AS 2460-030E to meet with a person, including a constituent, a group, or the employer described in question one, in a legislative office or conference room regarding the matter in which the legislator has the conflict of interest, if the legislator posts a public notice of the meeting through the office or the House Secretary or Senate Secretary, and the meeting is open to the public? Facts. You are employed part-time periodically by an employer outside of the legislature from whom you have received less than $10,000 in the immediately preceding 12-month period. The meeting described in the questions presented would be held in a legislative committee room, legislative conference room, or the office of an individual legislator. Page two, the discussion leads off with another site to E3, which we went over in the last discussion. Then it talks about official influence. It says it's not defined by the act, but we've previously found that it's broad enough to include legislative action. And then we cite the definition of legislative action in the Ethics Act. For purposes, I'm turning the page to page 3 now, for purposes of AS 2460.030, substantially benefit or harm means the effect on the person's financial interest is greater than the effect on the financial interest of the general public of the state. Financial interest is defined for purposes of the act under 2460.990A as follows, and then the definition of financial interest. Number one, does E3 prohibit a legislator who works part-time for an employer who paid the legislator less than $10,000 in the immediately preceding 12-month period from meeting privately as a legislator with that employee, with that employer? Answer, because you have not received more than $10,000 of income from the employer in the immediately preceding 12-month period, the conflict described under E3D does not apply. However, because you remain employed by the employer, the conflict under E3B does apply, but only to taking or withholding of official action or exerting official influence by you that could substantially benefit or harm the financial interest of your employer. If there's a piece of legislation that would substantially benefit or harm the financial interest of your employer, then E3 prohibits you from taking or withholding official action or exerting official influence in connection with that legislation, except for participating in a public discussion or debate or voting as provided in 2460.030G. Therefore, you would be prohibited from discussing that legislation with your employer privately. Number two, does the Act permit a legislator who has a conflict of interest under AS 2460.030E to meet with a person, including a constituent group or the employer described in question one, in a legislative office or conference room regarding the matter in which the legislator has the conflict of interest, if the legislator posts a public notice of the meeting and the meeting is open to the public? We have advised previously that AS 2460.030E3 contains an exception allowing participation in public discussion or debate. Under the facts provided, a legislator with a conflict under E would arrange or agree to meet with someone about the matter in which the legislator has the conflict of interest and would post a public notice of the meeting and allow members of the public to attend. Although this might constitute a public meeting, the legislator's conduct leading up to the meeting may constitute the taking of official action prohibited by E3. Whether notification of the meeting is made through the office of the chief clerk or Senate secretary or by some other means, the legislator would be taking official action to organize and promote a public discussion or debate. Organizing and promoting a public discussion or debate goes beyond the participation allowed under the exception in E3. If the legislator does not have a conflict of interest under E3, the prohibition on official action does not prevent the legislator from organizing or promoting the public discussion or debate. So it only applies if they have a conflict under one of those narrow categories. In this instance, the legislator does have a conflict of interest under E3, and therefore organizing and promoting the meeting would be prohibited official action under E3. And create a strong appearance of impropriety under AS 2460.010. Maybe we should say, when it says in this instance the legislator does have a conflict of interest under E3, we should clarify that it's talking about B, right? E3B.
Yes. It should be the employer.
As we advise in AO 707, the legislature set forth the Act's foundational principles in 2460.010, and the first one says, high moral and ethical standards among public servants in the legislative branch of government are essential to assure the trust, respect, and confidence of the people of this state. Creating the appearance of impropriety while in office is inconsistent with this principle. In previous advisory opinions, the committee has indicated that the appearance of impropriety would be a factor the committee would consider in determining whether or not the legislative act has been violated. Conclusion. In addition to the foregoing advice, we advise that compliance with the act is the individual responsibility of each person to whom it applies. In determining whether future conduct like that prescribed in the hypothetical facts violates the act, the committee will consider the applicable facts in each instance. An appearance of ethical impropriety would be a factor the committee would consider. this will, if it, once it's single space, it'll only be 3 pages long, so.
This will be good. So, Dan, you're suggesting on page 5 where it says, in that paragraph that starts with, in this instance, we change under E3 and then add B.
Right. It should say under E3B.
Right.
We've already said on a previous page that we don't have a conflict under D.
Okay.
This is Skip. I have a problem with the language. I mean, you're assuming that the legislator is going to set up this meeting and is going to post a notice. I think we should say the legislator's conduct leading up to the meeting would constitute the taking of official action. I mean, isn't that, haven't we said before that such things as noticing on a meeting and so on are to promote something are official action? So you said it may constitute the taking of official action. I think it is official action.
You're looking at the bottom of page 4.
Yeah.
The bottom of page 4, yeah.
Would arrange.
You said, although this might constitute a public meeting, the legislator's conduct leading up to the meeting.
Yeah, would I think would. It's more helpful if you can say would to say it, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah.
You're right. Lee pointed out at the top of page 5, it does say the legislator would be taking official action. So to be consistent, we would change may to would on page 4.
Right.
Okay. So it looks like we've got two suggested amendments, changing may to would on the bottom of page 4 and adding B after the line that says does have a conflict of interest under E3B.
And adding a reference to waiving of confidentiality on page
right, and waiving, right. And we always make a reference at the beginning to waiving confidentiality.
I mean, in the other one, you just did a footnote.
Is that how we did it?
Yeah.
Sorry. Right. We could do the same thing as we did in 1902, where you put you have waived confidentiality under 2460, 160.
Okay.
We'll just add that footnote. Okay.
Madam Chair.
Yes, go ahead, Representative Hannon.
And the E3B, the B notation addition would also be on page 5, correct, where it's referenced 3 times in that paragraph.
Mm-hmm. Just right, right. That's what we're doing on
B. But, yeah, you'd reference the one time, and I wanted to make sure I was.
Yes. Right, we would say if the legislator does not have a conflict of interest under E3B, and then we would say if they do, legislator does have a conflict under the E3B there, and well, correct, Dan? No?
I think that it sounds kind of silly to be talking about this in this, picking nits or whatever, but I think the first two E3s should stay the way they are because
they're more general.
If the legislator does not have a conflict
right.
under E3, then the prohibition doesn't apply or whatever.
And
in this instance, the legislator does have a conflict of interest. We could say
under E3B because the conflict of interest is related
and
to
therefore one. Organizing and promoting the meeting would be prohibited official action under E3B.
Okay.
Well, yeah. So I'll go with whatever way you tell me to do it.
I guess I agree with what you're saying. The other two are more generic because we're making more of a general statement, whereas the one about we're saying he does have a conflict of interest, it's under the specific section of E3B because that's what the question is.
I had one more question.
Skip, go ahead.
On page 1, we're under facts. Are we stating facts as they came in on the request? Is it how did that facts? It's not clear that I want to be clear that we're talking about the legislator. It just says you are employed. Is you should we say you a legislator or?
Well, the very first sentence says you are a legislator.
I know it does up there. Okay.
I guess we have used that in the past, Skip. So I'm okay with that.
That's all right.
And other advisory opinions.
So we could change it to say we could take the last sentence of the first paragraph on that page and move it down under facts, and then we could add to the facts, we could say you are a legislator and you are also employed.
Or we could say, as a legislator, you are employed.
Or you, comma, a legislator, comma, are employed. Either way, anyway, just
something like
just so it's clear who the
okay
that the legislator.
I don't. It doesn't matter to me.
I don't want to have that same problem we had in the other opinion.
So that was on the other opinion. The other opinion says statement of facts. So on this one, we should say statement of facts as well. Okay, we'll add statement of facts. Okay, so as of this point, we are adding a footnote about confidentiality on page one. We are stating statement of facts on page one. We are adding, what did we decide to add about, what are we saying, you?
You are a legislator, period.
You are
also employed part-time periodically by.
Okay, so we'll say you are a legislator. You are also employed. Okay. All right. Those are the changes on page one. And then on page four, we changed may to would in the last sentence of the full paragraph there, leading up to the meeting would constitute the taking official action. And then on page five, we've added on the very last sentence, or second to the last sentence, we've added E3B twice. The one that starts out with, in this instance, the legislator does have a conflict of interest. So those are the changes that are recommended. Okay, is there a motion to approve the advisory opinion as presented?
So moved.
Okay, Deb Fancher has made a motion to approve the opinion as presented with the, with the changes?
Mm-hmm.
With changes, okay. Any further discussion? Hearing no further discussion, we're required to take a roll call vote. And Jerry, if you would go ahead and do that.
Formal advisory opinion AO 1904 advises whether specific actions, including meeting in private in a legislator's office or in a conference room with a public notice or taking or withholding official action or exerting official influence under AS 2460-030E when a legislator has a conflict of interest. Roll call vote is to concur or not concur with the draft opinion. A vote of yes will be a vote to concur with the draft opinion as amended in the committee discussion. A vote of no will be to not concur with the draft opinion as amended in committee discussion. Member Lee Holmes.
Yes.
Representative Sarah Hannon.
Yes.
Representative Delana Johnson.
Yes.
Member Skip Cook.
Yes.
Member Connor Thomas.
Yes.
Member Joyce Anderson.
Yes.
Member Deb Fancher.
Yes.
With that, a vote of 7-0 to concur with the draft opinion as amended in committee discussion.
Okay, thank you. Senator Coghill and Senator Bennett Begich will be marked as absent. Okay, we are moving along to our draft advisory opinion 1905. And this is the last one that we are going to be addressing today. So I will, Dan, refer back to you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Question presented, does the Legislative Ethics Act permit a legislator employed as a residential property appraiser and married to a spouse employed as a mortgage loan originator to take official action or exert official influence, including sponsoring legislation, regarding HB 76 or a similar measure relating to state building codes? You've requested an advisory opinion concerning facts and circumstances that you've related. The committee relies on facts that you have described in answering your questions. You have waived your right to confidentiality under AS 2460-160B. Is that right, Jerry? That
yes.
There was a waiver?
Yes, correct.
I want to make sure it didn't just get left in here as an artifact of some previous draft or whatever. Statement of facts. You're a legislator and you are also employed as a residential property appraiser. Your spouse is employed by a financial institution as a mortgage loan originator. You are the sponsor of HB 76, a bill that, if enacted into law, would adopt the 2018 International Residential Code, IRC, as the state residential code. The bill would make the new state residential code the minimum standard for residential construction in the state, comma. However, it would allow the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation, AHFC, to replace the new state residential code by adopting either a later edition of the IRC or another nationally recognized code in place of the 2018 IRC as the minimum standard for residential construction in the state. Regardless of whether the new state residential code is based on the 2018 IRC or another code substituted later by the AHFC, HB 76 requires municipal building codes to meet or exceed the prevailing standards under a new state residential code. On the next page, we cite again 2460.030E3, and we go through the same discussion of the definition of official influence and official action. And then page 3, we go through the same discussion of what substantially benefit or harm means, and the definition of financial interest. Then we say, as a preliminary matter, we note the prohibition under 2460.030E3 does not apply in a circumstance when the sole effect of the prohibited conduct would be to substantially benefit or harm the financial interest of a person who's not listed in E3, A through D. While E3 clearly implies that the financial interest of a legislator or another person who's not listed might indirectly benefit or be indirectly harmed by legislation that could directly and substantially harm or benefit the financial interest of a person listed in E3, A through D, the prohibition explicitly covers only benefit or harm to those persons listed in E3, A through D. However, E3 does not explicitly prohibit a legislator from taking or withholding official action or exerting official influence when the sole effect of doing so could substantially benefit or harm the financial interest of the legislator and not a person listed in E3, A through D. That paragraph looks familiar because it's probably identical to the one in the last opinion, or in 1902 that the committee adopted a few minutes ago. Let's see. Then there's a footnote here. We should mention those. We say AO 1901, which cites AO 1105 regarding our advice in AO 0701, that a legislator's introduction of a bill that could substantially benefit the legislator's employer would be of special concern to the committee in connection with AS 2460.030E. If the bill were introduced at a time when the legislator is negotiating terms of employment with that employer. And then footnote 3, nevertheless, in those circumstances, other provisions of the Act still apply, including a requirement under 030G that a legislator who has a conflict of interest under G declare a conflict of interest before voting on a related question before a committee of the legislature and request to be excused from voting on a related question before a House of the legislature. Page 4. In AO 1901, we advise that even when a legislator with a conflict of interest under E3 is permitted by E3 to participate in a public discussion or debate, we recommend that the legislator declare the conflict of interest even for the limited purpose of discussing the matter. We advised in AO 1805 and later in our reply to question 4 in 1901 that a legislator with a conflict of interest under E3 would, in an informal or non-public discussion, be prohibited from taking any official action or exerting official influence, including advocating for the bill. The same would be true of other types of legislation in addition to bills. Therefore, a legislator with a conflict of under E3 that relates to a piece of legislation may not take or withhold official action or exert official influence on that legislation, including discussing or advocating on it for it. A legislator's discussion of or advocacy for or against proposed legislation in any kind of meeting would probably constitute official action, official influence, or both. In a private meeting, even with other legislators, the public discussion or debate exception in AS 2460.030E3 would not apply. One thing that this opinion, one way to improve that paragraph would probably be to cite to AO 1902, that the committee just adopted, because it talks about circumstances where it may be official action, circumstances where it may not. But since it hadn't been approved yet, I didn't cite to it here in this draft. But I think that might be helpful.
I would have no problem with adding that in there.
Just something like, you know, however, see our discussion in AO 1902, which, you know, or something like that.
What is the feeling of the rest of the committee? Make a reference to 1902, the one we just passed.
Yeah, could it be done in the first sentence along with 1805 and 1901?
Or 02? 1902.
The first sentence already references
two of them.
Right.
Just add the third one into the first sentence.
Through the chair.
Yes, go ahead, Dan.
I think that that just sort of dilutes it and takes away the reason for putting it in there, which is to clarify these bottom two sentences saying, you know, you can't have this kind of meeting.
So you're talking of putting a footnote maybe in after the last.
After.
Would not apply.
May not take it with all, including.
In the second paragraph?
The last sentence of that paragraph.
Right, in a private meeting, even with other legislators, is that the one you're talking about?
It says, yeah, that one.
Mm-hmm. Okay, putting a footnote there.
Because it talks about any kind of meeting. And maybe we could just put it after any kind of meeting in the middle of the sentence. Is that okay, do you think?
Sure, yes.
Because that's really what I'm hoping it does. Is it says, okay, you want any kind of meeting? What do you mean? What if
so
I'm meeting with my
meeting,
teenage daughter in my office and she wants to know about a bill, you know?
So after the word meeting, you put a footnote referencing 1902. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Or at the end of the sentence. Where are we talking about? After the
meeting? After any kind of meeting.
Right. Okay.
Just because I think it really puts a point on it that the person can go right to it. Because it is a pretty sweeping statement.
Okay.
Okay. There may be instances where a legislator with a conflict of interest under E3 can meet privately with certain persons and discuss the legislation causing the conflict. Those instances include circumstances where the legislator is clearly not acting in a legislative role and not taking or withholding official action or exerting official influence. However, those instances generally do not include discussion with legislative employees, registered lobbyists, or other legislators. In those instances, there's a rebuttable presumption that the legislator is acting in a legislative role and that holding the meeting is official action prohibited by E3. That would be another place to put the same footnote.
Okay.
Sponsoring legislation. As we advised in 1805 and 1901, a legislator's introduction or sponsorship of legislation is always discretionary because the uniform rules never require a legislator to introduce or sponsor legislation, and choosing to do so in spite of a conflict of interest would be contrary to goals of the Act as set forth in 2460.010. Moreover, sponsoring or co-sponsoring legislation of any kind, including an amendment, requires taking official action or exerting official influence. We just kind of read the same paragraph in the previous opinion, so I'm going to skip to the end of it. I'm going to suggest adding to the first line of that paragraph a cite to 1902.
First line of which paragraph, Dan?
That same one, big paragraph in the middle of the page.
One.
As we advised in 1805, 1901, and AO 1902. And we're collecting a string of similar things. Then applying the next paragraph, applying 2460.030(e)(3) to the facts provided, it does not appear that you have a conflict of interest under E3. Absent additional facts, your outside employment, your spouse's employment, and the substantive provisions of HB 76 do not suggest that you're taking or withholding of official action or exertion of official influence in connection with HB 76, including sponsoring the bill, could substantially benefit or harm the financial interest of a person, A, who's a member of your immediate family, B, by whom you or a member of your immediate family is employed, C, with whom you are negotiating for employment, or D, from whom you or a member of your immediate family has, in the immediately preceding 12-month period, received more than $10,000 of income. Now, having said that, I mean, those, based on the facts that that were presented, you know, which sort of like is sort of like a teaser, well, you know, maybe there's something here, but you know, you really can't say that there is. You can speculate, well, what is the name of the employer that they work for, and are these folks, have those companies identified how this bill is going to make them money, or some aspect of it is going to harm them? You know, I don't know. We just don't have those facts, and they may not even be there. So, based on what the facts that were presented, it doesn't look like there's any kind of a conflict. Then the section about high moral and ethical standards from that was in the last draft, I think it's identical. Compliance with the Act is the individual responsibility of each person to whom it applies. In determining whether future conduct like that described in the hypothetical facts violates the Act, the committee will consider the applicable facts in each instance. An appearance of ethical impropriety would be a factor the committee would consider. And then in the conclusion restates the question and says, for the reasons stated above and based on the facts presented, the committee finds that you do not have a conflict of interest under E3, and therefore E3 does not prohibit you from taking or withholding official action or exerting official influence, including sponsoring legislation regarding HB 76 or a similar measure relating to building codes. However, we look at the specific facts in each instance. You and your spouse are both employed in work or for employers that may be affected in some way by legislation affecting the construction and financial industries. If the facts in this instance later indicate that you or your spouse could substantially benefit from or be harmed by the passage or failure, I think we should add, of HB 76 or a similar bill, a conflict of interest may arise. And I'd like to say something about that sentence. When I read it this morning, I thought somebody might read that and say, well, does that mean that after the bill passes and then some benefit arises, then now I have a conflict? What am I supposed to do about it then? I didn't know about it at the time. I think it's confusing.
It does read like that.
So I'm suggesting rewriting it to say, to cross out the facts in this instance later and insert in its place, additional facts become known that, and then cross out that on the next line. So I'll read it this way, and I'm totally open to suggestions, but this is what I came up with kind of quickly this morning. If additional facts become known that indicate you or your spouse could substantially benefit from or be harmed by the passage or failure of HB 76 or a similar bill, a conflict of interest may arise. I don't know if that fixes it or not, but it's a little more clear.
Dan, read it one more time, because I was sort of focusing on the beginning of the sentence.
If additional facts become known that indicate you or your spouse could substantially benefit from or be harmed by the passage of HB 70 or failure of HB 76 or a similar bill, a conflict of interest may arise. We could say, or harmed by HB 76 or a similar bill, no, that doesn't say that.
So
anyway.
So I think what you said the first time was, if additional facts become known that indicate you or your spouse could substantially benefit from or be harmed by the passage or failure of HB 76 or a similar bill, a conflict of interest may arise. Is that what you're saying?
Yes.
Okay. What are the thoughts of the committee on that?
I thought it was confusing in Lee Holmes.
The original sentence?
It just, we're throwing conjecture in there. I think we should just stick to, here's the bill, here's what we say, we don't have a conflict, and I don't think we need a catch-all phrase at the end that says, in the future. I don't like statements like that.
So you're saying we should stick with just however we look at the specific facts in each instance. You and your spouse are both employed and work for employers that may be affected by some way or in some way by legislation affecting the construction of financial industries, and leave it at that.
Yeah. I'm almost the entire paragraph I would take out, because the conclusion is the paragraph above, which is answering the specific question. The second paragraph is pure conjecture as to, well, something might come up in the future. I guess my thing on that would be is you have to look at each instance, and this instance is based on the facts provided, which is House Bill 76, and it's not substantive to their professions at this point. So it doesn't create a conflict. Anything in the future. I mean, we don't put a statement on the other ones that says, in the future, that could change. I just didn't see a reason for that paragraph.
Okay. Further discussion? Representative Hannon.
Thank you, through the chair. I agree with Member Holmes. When we added, or when the suggestion was passage or failure of the bill, that really put me to the end of, like, now we're really speculating, because if it passes, you might have a conflict. If it fails, you might have a conflict. And if it fails, it's status quo. Nothing has changed. So we're missing the point of the inquiry, which was, can I sponsor this legislation that doesn't directly necessarily change the financial implications of our, by instituting a residential building code, will appraisal rates raise to the point that I would have a financial benefit, which I think is the crux of the question, because it's not a direct tie that appraisal rates will change if we have a residential code, but certainly appraising will change if we have a statewide residential code. But we don't know if they're going to be substantial enough to impact you financially. If the bill fails, then nothing changes. But the question is, can I sponsor this? And it's very speculative, which certainly drives an engineer to. Engineers tend to be more precise than speculative, hopefully. We want those civil engineers to have very precise decision making in their contemplation. So I see where it gives him heartburn, and I was not sure why I had heartburn till we went or failure, and then I went, well, now I'm really wondering if that does anything to clarify the initial question.
Thank you. Any further Connor Thomas?
I would point out that on the very first page, it starts out and says the committee relies on facts that you have described in answering your questions. So it kind of lays out that this is what we're going with.
So based on some discussion, it looks like we might want to just eliminate that whole paragraph.
I move we approve the decision eliminating that last paragraph. And with the other, and were there other changes?
We had a couple.
With the changes made, but including eliminating that last paragraph.
Okay, so we have a motion to approve the advisory opinion with the changes recommended, including eliminating the last paragraph on page 7. Is there further discussion? Why don't I go over the changes that we made? What we did was we added on page 4, we added advisory opinion 1902 as a footnote after the word meeting, where it says any kind of meeting. We have added a footnote on the top of page 5 after the last sentence of that partial paragraph at the top where it says E3. We're going to add a footnote referencing advisory opinion 1902. And then also where it says sponsoring legislation on page 5, we're going to add as we advised in AO 1805, AO 1901, and AO 1902. We're adding that in there. So those, we've added advisor opinion 1902 three times, changed one word, and deleted a paragraph. Those are the, just reiterating what the motion was. So is there further discussion? If not, we will take a roll call vote.
Madam Chair, there's one point. Is the bill, I think, is in your packet.
Mm-hmm.
And should that, does anything need to be done to formally make that part of the facts or the?
Well, we do say at the end of the advisory opinion attachment, Exhibit A, copy of HB 76. So I think that's.
Okay, that covers it then.
That
all right.
Covers it.
That was the only question I had.
Okay. All right. If there's no further discussion, I think we're ready for a roll call vote.
Formal advisory opinion, AO 1905, advises whether a legislator who is a residential appraiser and who has a spouse who is a mortgage originator may take or withhold official action or exert official influence under AS 2460-030E and G on legislation replacing the state residential code specifically referencing HB 76. Roll call vote to concur or not to concur with this draft opinion. A vote of yes will be a vote to concur with the draft opinion. A vote of no will be not to concur with the draft opinion. Both, of course, as amended during the committee discussion. Member Lee Holmes.
Yes.
Representative Sarah Hannon.
Yes.
Representative Delana Johnson.
Yes.
Member Skip Cook.
Yes.
Member Connor Thomas.
Yes.
Member Joyce Anderson.
Yes.
Member Deb Fancher.
Yes.
7-0, concurring with the draft opinion as amended during committee discussion. Senator Tom Begich and Senator John Coghill absent from the discussion and voting.
All right. Thank you, Jerry. Do we need to take a quick break, or should we continue? We need to take a quick break. All right, let's take a.
She's about to sprint out of here.
5-minute break.
Thank you.
item number 8, which is the chair staff report. So I am going to start with A, which is House Complaint 1703. We're going to have an update on that. That is tab H in your packet. So I'm going to refer that to our administrator, Jerry Anderson, to fill us in on that one.
This again deals with H-1703 complaint regarding Representative David Eastman, who filed an appeal to the Superior Court regarding the Ethics Committee opinion. The order that you have is an order granting motion to dismiss appeal. We used outside counsel on that, specifically Brent Cole, on that for purposes of our appeal. With this, pending further appeal, there is a motion for attorney's fees that we would be seeking attorney's fees on that. That's still pending. It hasn't been ruled on. But other than that, this is the extent of where that's at. And, of course, there's briefs behind this and lots of other legal work that had to be done with regard to this particular appeal. But just advising the committee regarding that.
And Jerry, if I could just add, and for the new members as well and the members of the public who are here, is that whenever there's a complaint, it's always confidential until the decision is issued. Then once the decision is issued, it becomes public. So the reason this is on the full committee agenda and not on a House subcommittee agenda is because a complaint was issued, and then everything related to that afterwards would be more of a public matter. So just wanted to clarify that.
Absolutely right. This complaint came through the full process of the complaint process. So it had a public hearing and was appealed from that public hearing decision. The next item I just wanted to let the committee know was...
Yes, Representative Hannon.
Thank you. Could I just ask, so the appeal has been dismissed, but the state via the Ethics Committee is seeking... attorney fees compensation, so that's just a court procedural action, not
right
and done standardly.
Right. Correct. Prevailing party seeking attorney's fees under specific rules of the court.
Okay.
But the time for appeal hadn't run yet, so
it has not. And I do not have a specific date for that. I've asked our counsel for that, but I do not know that date.
It looks like 30 days from the distribution date.
Okay, just for a little bit further information, I was committee administrator from 2001 through 2015, and during my 15 years, there was never an appeal to the courts based on an ethics decision. So when you say routine, or whatever was the word you used, it really isn't routine?
No, routine for the attorney's fees.
Right, right, but I mean yeah. Routine even for this.
But it is routine in litigation to... ask for attorney's fees.
Yes, yes. But with the Ethics Committee, there has not been an appeal to the court system regarding, and usually the ethics ruling is final. And so Representative Eastman went to the courts for that. So that's unusual in the years that, and even before my time, there was one, but it was way, way back. And so this appealing to the court system is not normal.
I appreciate that clarification.
I shouldn't say normal, it's not routine.
It's not routine. Do I dare ask then how long it takes to get attorney's fees back from?
I will defer to the attorney.
Is there a standard that the court follows for that?
Yeah, it is standard. It is standard.
Is there a standard time frame?
Well,
it becomes a judge.
It's up to the judge. They have 6 months to make a decision from the time that all the documents have been submitted to them, so usually it's much quicker than that, but that's the time frame.
This raises some issues we haven't faced before. If the court, say, imposed attorney's fees, are they against Eastman personally, or are they against him to where he can pay them out of his legislative funds? We as a committee usually can't, we can recommend to the legislature sort of penalties, but in this case it's the court, so it's a different, if it's a different ball game, and it'd be interesting to see whether, I suppose he filed as, I understand he's been using legislative office funds to pay his counsel, but whether he can reimburse us or reimburse out of them if there's a judgment against him, I don't know.
I'm not privy to the specifics of that, but my understanding is he is not using office allowance account funds for that purpose, because that would not be under the general guidelines of reasonably related to serving in office.
I would hope not, actually. But,
and so... Yeah.
Are you talking about poet account funds?
No, office allowance account.
What about a poet account?
Poet account is administered by APOC, so we would not have any... say in that matter.
But no, could he use it for that, though?
That's up to APOC. I don't know.
Again, my understanding is the same type of guideline applies, but again, that would be a ruling by APOC, reasonably related to serving in office.
For the new legislators as well, what was being referred to is there is a list of sanctions that are allowed under the statute, and one of them is to recover attorney's fees, which would have been after the decision was made by the committee. This is a little bit different because it went to the courts. So it's sort of a separate, fill me in if I'm wrong, sort of a separate thing. But, you know, there could be a letter of reprimand. There could be a public letter of apology. There could be attorney's fees. There could be sanctions, which have happened in the past regarding committee travel because it was a violation against using, you know, state funds for travel purposes. I mean, there's all of those sort of things that are available in the statute that the Ethics Committee could look at when they're looking at a complaint if they find a finding of probable cause. Representative Johnson.
What is the total amount of attorney's fees that we're seeking to recover?
I don't know. Jerry wouldn't have that.
The amount that's been expended on that contract to date that we have is with outside counsel that was approved by the committee was bumped up to $5,000. We've since had to have that increased. We do not have the contract back from Ledge Legal, but through consultation with the chair, we've asked for $8,000. We will not expend that. It would be actually about just shy of $6,000 that our council has indicated spent on the billings that we have for this process. From the filing that was originally made in December of 2018 and following through with all of those items, the expected recovery on that would probably be less than one third based on my conversation with with our counsel.
But what we probably will not recover anything on was the attorney's fees that we expended for the hearing officer for the hearing that he demanded from us, and that was even way more than that. But
yes, oh yes, our budget for that they both exceeded $20,000, both for a hearing officer and our counsel.
Right. So it cost us about $50,000 altogether.
Any further questions?
Well, I don't know.
Okay. Anything else, Jerry, on that, or should we move on to B, which is an update on ethics training?
Our ethics training, I want to report that, although I don't have the exact numbers on that, we have confirmed that everyone who was employed greater than 30 days ago has completed their ethics training. That was accomplished using the video training that we incorporated from sessions that we did earlier. For those that are coming on board, they have the laborious task of going through 6 hours and 10 minutes of ethics training between the sessions. And so right now, the versions that we're using are 6 hours and 10 minutes. And so, you know, congratulations to all those house staffers who ended up going through all of those. Obviously, 40 minutes of that would not apply to anyone who is not a house staffer, because that would be what was traditionally segment for information designed specifically for staffers, either in the House or Senate.
And now that we're tasked with conducting two types of training, one for ethics training and one for have a mental block.
Sexual harassment.
Thank you. Sexual harassment. Trying to think of the best way to say that. Sexual harassment, that's why the training is so long, because the Ethics Committee has now been charged with both of those, not just ethics training, but on the other side as well.
So with that, unless there's other specific questions, I think we can move on to. The question posed by the chair was whether or not we should approve the amended amount for the contract, and that is being drafted by LAA, and so it's not available for this meeting. The chair is designated to approve, and she did approve the increase from $5,000 to $8,000 for our outside counsel for period starting January 1st. And so what we will end up with is right at $2,000 left in that contract for the rest of the fiscal year, which is enough to get started on any issue that may arise with outside counsel.
And I guess my question, Jerry, was is that even though the chair approves it, I think it needs to be brought up at a full committee meeting to have the committee approve it. I can preliminarily approve it, but then have it brought up in a formal meeting. Is that necessary is my question.
Well,
we don't have to have the contract in front of us. We're just approving the appropriation for to increase the contract to that amount.
I think we usually have brought those back to the committee.
Yes, we have. I'm pretty sure we have as well. So I guess I would like to do that.
Okay, and I just point out that it's not on our agenda.
It's not noted.
And I don't have the actual contract that's being drafted, and that's my hesitation, Madam Chair. But if you wish to go forward with that, I can, you know, put again on that. It would be an increase from $5,000 to $8,000 for the outside contract that we have with Brent Cole's law firm.
Why don't we put that under other business, under item 10, when we get to item 10. We'll go back to that and approve that. Let's move on to item 9, which is the legislation update.
Okay. Passed yesterday was the CS for Senate Bill number 89 and from a Judiciary Committee, and the members have been provided a copy of that that bill, and I guess I can defer to Senator Coghill, who has rejoined our meeting, because this came from, as I understand, from the Rules Committee.
Right. Thank you, Madam Chair, and Executive Director and committee members. So Senate Bill 89 was brought out of the Rules Committee, referred to Judiciary, and it proposed to kind of do a reset. So we debated it on the floor yesterday in the Senate, and it passed, not unanimously. And one would not be surprised that an ethics bill would ever pass unanimously. So it opens up a lot of questions, and rightfully so.
And what was the vote, Senator?
I can't remember. I think it was 15-4. 15-4. Okay. Right. So I mean, it passed fairly handily. The question before the legislature in this bill was based on some of the opinions that you all went through while I was gone, and my apologies for having to go. I had a caucus meeting, and just as part of the leadership team, you can't just say no to the caucus meeting. This attempts to answer some of the things that were actually asked Dan Wayne as we were going through some of the opinions on how do we deal with the family members, how do we deal with the public-private meeting question. So the way we thought to do it in the Senate was to just revert back to a language as best we could that was previously used, taking the family members out and making, if there's a financial interest that benefits you, the legislator, or somebody you're seeking employment for, that's clear. It's easy to get the answer to. It was harder to get to the questions on those within your household. How does that work? Especially under the condition where we had the definitions that were very, very broad, both with financial interest and substantial gain. So we reverted back to original language on that. I don't know that totally satisfied everybody, obviously, 15-4. We're going to pass it over to the House for them to consider it. they did like some of the stuff we did, and that is you declare the conflict in front of a committee and in front of the floor. There is not a uniform rule change with this, but it still puts people on notice that when they are for real conflicted, they better start speaking up about it. Part of the problem that we've had is under the existing law we have now that HB 44 passed, there's a lot of unclear questions that have chilled legislative action. That's all. It's made people reluctant to do things. And here's the thing. If you're unethical, you don't care. But if you want to be at the highest possible ethical standard, you do care, and hence the chilling effect. And so what you do is you throttle back those who want to follow the letter of the law as best they can, even the spirit of the law, which we all want them to do. But it created questions, as you all saw in the ethics opinions that you all had to draft. So I won't go over all that. We just wanted to get back to some clarity on those of us who are going to follow the law, because there's going to be those who don't. and we want it as clear as we can get that, yes, that's unethical behavior. So we went back to some of the original language. The equity or ownership against a financial interest. The immediate family members all went out. I think there's a reasonable discussion there. It's just that probably in context, the 120 days that we have to do what we got to do today, there's probably three big things that are going to crowd everything out. These are going to be the elephants stomping through the forest here in the legislature. Our budget, the permanent fund dividend, and criminal questions. And they are going to literally force everything off the table. With the governor having a very strong opinion on some things and the House and the Senate trying to figure out how to act in between those. So trying to rewrite the ethics code this year wouldn't be easily successful, and if we left it as it was, it would make it harder for us to do our job. So we tried to go the path of least resistance and go back to language we understood and move forward. So that's really what this bill is trying to do. Now, the Senate agreed to that. The House has yet to hear it and agree to it. And so it's halfway there. But that is the general rationale. Without going into all the details, I see where you actually have a PowerPoint that was given by Chad Hutchison in front of the Judiciary Committee. That probably tells the whole story, basically. And so you don't need me to bore you with all those details. The politics of it are still what I would call tenuous, but not negatively tenuous. It's just that any time you bring the ethics question up, it gets testy. And at this point, I would say it looks like there's a general agreement that a simple approach like this might go through. So that's probably the best I can report to you right now, because we're halfway there.
So it is waiting to be heard by the House.
It has been already noticed in the Judiciary Committee pending referral. So it is going to be read across probably tomorrow morning when they have their floor session. And then the Judiciary Committee on the House side has agreed that they will bring it right up. So at least it takes front and center action. And it really needs to, as you will understand, we're going to be rapidly entering into that land where the budget is going to dominate everybody's discussion here. And that's probably going to happen within the next 10 days. So this issue needs to be fairly well dispatched before those 10 days start distracting everybody from being able to think about it. So I think the House wants to deal with it. Now the question is, will they be able to under this approach? And I hope they will. But as the Senate always knows, we're not in charge of the House, and we love them dearly, and so we hope the best for them.
Are there any questions for Senator Coghill? Representative Hannon.
I will chime in. Thank you, through the chair. And I certainly cannot speak for the House, nor the House leadership, nor the House minority, but as a new member to the legislature, prior to the day the governor's amended budget came out, the biggest topic of discussion was how House Bill 44 and the reforms on ethics had tied people's hands and created things. So there certainly is interest in seeing a resolution in the immediate sense, but as a teacher, one of the things that was always a surprise is you would think that something was going to be an hour. Perhaps the chemistry teacher was more precise. Mm-hmm. You thought this was going to take an hour, and it took 5 minutes or it took 5 hours. Yeah. And it was an unpredictability from where you stood as a teacher, because you always had to come back to where the kids were at the moment of being able to take that information in. So the House certainly has an interest in expediting this, just like the Senate did. But from where I sit as a freshman, I have no idea whether that means we can get this done in the next 60. We're
72 days now, so we've got 40 some days left. Mr. Executive Director, Madam Chair, I have been working steadily on this for the last 70 days. So just to let you know, trying to get people to understand it, agree to it, and really it takes public understanding, which is hard to get in an arcane business like this, because really it is rules to keep us accountable on those areas where there's a lot of individual circumstances, as Dan Wayne will continue to say. It just depends, you know. And we want to hold people accountable, and we want to have clear rules. But when they're ambiguous and difficult, what you do is you chill a process. And even talking about this in public has chilled legislators from wanting to do certain things. And so, it's not even just the appearance. It's the I don't know. So an appearance of impropriety is one thing. But when you don't even want to go near an issue, all of a sudden, what you're doing is taking the constitutional form of government and putting it in the negative spot that is inappropriate and probably unfortunate. So, but as I've had the discussion the last 70 days in the Senate, it's just been that tough. So, and it's probably not going to be any easier in the House. However, I have worked closely with the House members as we've gone through this. But I could say we're not unanimous with them yet.
But I can say the House is not unanimous. That's the one thing I can assure you.
So are there any questions of Senator Coghill? Dan, is there anything you want to add regarding when drafting, or you've used all your words for today?
So it's all good.
You've used all your words for today.
I don't have anything to add. It's kind of a policy discussion, really. And I'm here if anyone has a question about.
Madam Chair, to his defense, he gets peppered with questions from multifaceted questions from every side. And some of them are, what if we do this? And he has to look down the road, and what if we do this? And sometimes we've asked them so close that he has a hard time even distinguishing between our questions. So. We have been trying to discern a policy call, but he has been put in a very, very tough circumstance, both with this committee and with many of our members. So I'm going to come to his defense. We get to do the policy call. He gets to write it.
And on that note, the Legislative Ethics Committee doesn't pass the legislation or create the legislation. Mm-hmm. We only enforce the legislation.
Right.
So we've always said that at our training, because sometimes people wonder why why they have to do what they have to do. So I would have to say I'm very happy with the change that was made in here personally. I'm going to speak as a personal, where you added the committee back in here, because I noticed you've taken it out before, and I think it's so important for a legislator to declare conflicts at the conflict of interest at the committee level, because that is where the public is involved. That's where the public comes to testify. That's where the committee discussion is before it actually goes to the floor. And so I think it's important for the public to know that there is a conflict at that level. So I'm really glad to see that back in there. Any other comments? Okay, we're going to move to other business. I'm leaving it with Jerry if he thinks we should do the dollar amount as the executive director. So I'm going to leave it with you. If you think we should, we will. If you think we should wait for the contract, we will wait for the contract. What is your opinion or feeling on that?
I think it doesn't hurt for the committee to give that direction in terms of doing that. So If there's a motion to increase the contract for Brent Cole as our outside counsel from $5,000 to $8,000, I can take a roll call vote on that.
Okay, is there a motion?
So moved.
Okay, a motion has been made. Is there any further any discussion?
I'm sorry. Can I ask
a question? Yes, I'm sorry. I thought you were pointing to someone else. I'm sorry, Representative Johnson.
So from what I understand, this is something that would normally be under the purview of the chair to do anyway to, I don't know how much authority the chair has to increase this. So what we're really doing is confirming the action of the chair. Is that correct?
That's correct. I'll read to you what our rules of procedure say, because I looked them up while we were sitting here.
2C?
Yes, 2C.
If you want to follow along in your rules of procedure.
It says contracts. Contracts with the committee must receive approval in a public meeting of a majority of the members of the full committee. If it is an issue under the jurisdiction of the full committee or a majority of the members of the subcommittee, if it is an issue under the jurisdiction of the subcommittee. Members of the full committee and members of the subcommittee delegate authority to the chair of the appropriate committee or subcommittee to serve as project director for approved contracts. The chair may approve extensions of contracts until the next meeting after notification to committee members and majority approval. Extended contracts shall then be placed on the appropriate committee agenda in a public meeting for a majority vote of the full committee. I guess the question is, we don't have a contract in front of us. Mm-hmm. So that was the question, whether we should be doing it at this point or not. But the chair does have the authority, and then it goes to the full committee or the House. Or one,
well, we have a contract. It's just it's simply all we're doing is extending the amount.
Right.
So the question I think that we're facing is whether it was noticed on for this meeting.
It's not on the agenda.
It's not on the agenda. So I think that's the only question. Mm-hmm.
And could we put it under other business?
We have a motion, so let's do it.
Okay, so we have a motion on the floor. Are there any other questions? Do you have a further question, Representative Johnson?
My only question would be about putting it under unfinished business or other business, if there was any problem with that was foreseen. I don't know if we have, do we have counsel for the committee? I'm not sure.
Well, if there's a question regarding that, we will just hold it till the next committee meeting.
And I can withdraw the motion.
Okay. We will go ahead and do that. Our counsel is our outside counsel, who doesn't usually come to the committee meetings unless we require him to be here.
Yeah.
So, Representative Johnson.
Thank you. I just think, given the circumstances and the unusual nature of how all this has went, that it's smart to follow everything to the nth degree, I guess.
Okay. All right. So, other business. Under other business, we have our next meeting. We are not sure when we are having another meeting. It depends on business that comes before the committee. I know Jerry was asking earlier, some of us not in the formal meeting, as to what the schedule is. So I'm assuming legislators are going to be here, so their schedule would depend on committee meetings and so forth. So basically, he was asking the public members what their schedules were. We'll work around that with the public or the legislators if we come up with a meeting date for another meeting at this point. Our meetings are always held in Juneau during the legislative session, so you don't travel. We're the ones that travel. Otherwise, they're held in Anchorage.
Are we realistically contemplating another meeting during the legislative session, or is it probably going to be after?
I believe it's going to be after the legislative session, unless something comes in that would change that agenda.
And what I heard when Jerry was asking was Member Holmes was going to be unavailable August, September, October. So then are we looking at probably a meeting between the end of session and 1st of August?
Probably. End of session, 1st of August. That sounds good. We also have the House subcommittee is meeting today, and it depends on what happens with the House subcommittee meeting as to whether there will be another meeting for the House subcommittee, which does not include the senators. So that I can't answer at this point. But for the full committee meeting, I'm assuming we'll probably have one before August. Jerry?
We have one advisory opinion that's still outstanding. Confidentiality has been waived on that also. And Of course, Dan Wayne, at this point in time, a very busy time for him. And so that is the only unfinished business that we have. And, of course, it was, you know, scheduled in our packet in the event that it actually was written. But that is the only item that I know of, other than some administrative things that we could take care of at an additional meeting.
And that advisory opinion only is pertinent at a particular time of the year, which is not happening right now. So it's okay, I would think, that we hold on that advisory opinion because it's not an urgent decision that's needed at this point.
Madam Chair, if I may, that's greatly appreciated. And I should say that anything that I draft, anything that you've heard here today or read today, or anything that I draft, goes through about five or six or more people who carefully read every word. So we go through many drafts before it finally gets to this point. And so all of those people are really weighted down with a lot of extra stuff right now. So any kind of a break from that is really helpful.
Well, we will have to check with the requester the advisory opinion, because by statute there is a certain time frame, and the requester can waive that time frame. So that's something that we would have to do, but I can't imagine that individual would not waive that time frame.
And this is a matter of public, of course, because confidentiality has been waived, and it came up from our January 31st meeting, as you may recall, and the requester on that was Senator Begich, a member of our committee.
Yes. So I can't imagine that he would waive that time frame that we have. So I'm not anticipating a meeting unless something comes up until after session. And the House is a little different. We'll figure that out later. Okay, anything else on the next meeting? Anybody hit? Also, if any, because we have new members, if any of the members ever feel that there's an agenda item that needs to be brought up, please let Jerry know, and we can add that to our agenda as well. So we prepare an agenda based on the events that are happening and the requests that have been received. So if you feel there's anything we need to address, as I said, let him know. Okay, I think at this point it's time to adjourn. It's 1:52. Thank you, Lee. Motion to adjourn at 1:52. We were expecting to be done well before this. Yes.